Harper Audio presents Hill Towns by Anne Rivers Siddons, performed by Marcia Gay Harden. When I was 5 years old, I made a coldly desperate decision to live forever in a town on a hill. And so I have, from that terrible night in June until this one, 37 years and 1 month later. If it has been bad for me, I can only consider that anything else would have been worse. They never saw it coming. They didn't know what hit them, everybody said after my parents were struck and killed by a speeding truck on the old chain bridge over Tolliver's Creek. After that, I knew as simply and inalterably as a child knows anything, that staying alive meant always being able to see what was coming, always knowing what might hit you. So when my father's parents, kind and substantial Virginians from the Tidewater, who might have given me every advantage, made to take me home with them after the funeral, I simply screamed and screamed until, in despair, they left me behind with my mother's eccentric people who lived at the top of the mountain. I had great affection for my Virginia grandparents and little for the erratic, reclusive Caches, but the ramshackle, overgrown cash house commanded the Blue Ridge foothills in all directions. From there, I could always know what was coming. From there, I would see it long before it saw me. I could not have explained that at age 5, of course. I have only just recently become fully aware of it. Then, I only knew that on the mountain I was safe, and off it I was not. Everything in my small being strained after my grandmother and grandfather Compton as they drove away. But the new flatland fear was stronger. It held me on the mountain through all those years that, in retrospect, seemed to have been lived in a kind of green darkness, until I met Joe Gilliard in my senior year at Trinity College, and the last lingering darkness took fire into light. When I told him about my parents' death, he cried. I stared at him doubtfully. No one had ever cried upon hearing the manner of their deaths, and some few laughed outright, nervous, half-stifled laughter. I learned early to parrot laughter at Montview Day, where my Compton grandparents' absentee largesse sent me, when the children taunted me with it. Cats, Mom and Daddy, fuck themselves to death. Hey, Cat, want to go out and hump on the bridge? I'm lucky you weren't a serial murderer or a Republican, I told Joe later. I would have married you anyway. It's pretty obvious I would have married the first man who didn't wince and grin and say, well, at least they died happy. I wasn't crying for them. They probably did die happy, he said. I was crying for you. Nobody should laugh at a child's grief. Nobody. Joe was a lovely man then, in the supple youth of his 20s, the image of my father when he smiled. My father was a tall, fair boy who came to Trinity College because his father and grandfather had come before him, and before them, his great-grandfather Cornelius Compton, an Episcopal bishop, had helped found the university. The theological seminary, Compton Hall, bore their name, and young Corny Compton IV from Tidewater was destined to take his place in the Southern Episcopal hierarchy. Instead, he met my mother in the village at the start of his senior year, in our lone dry-cleaning establishment. She had come down from the very top of Morgan's Mountain to make a little money and see a little life, and all his fine passion fled the church in a rush and poured into her. They were married by the new year, and I appeared in the earliest days of New Green May. I was a quiet child who absorbed a great deal of grown-up talk, and while I was still small, I came to know that my mother and father had done it practically the day they met and whenever after they could. I knew what it was, too, vaguely. I heard them so often whispering and laughing, and then breathing in that sharp, short way, and finally moaning and shouting aloud, that I ceased to be curious and never even bothered to spy on them. I truly believe that they loved each other profoundly, as well as lusted after each other, and much of that love overflowed onto me. We were a happy little family, even though both sets of my grandparents predicted nothing for us but ruin. My father managed to graduate from Trinity, though his grades were flaccid and his ambition flown, and after commencement, he simply stayed on in Montview and got a job at the hardware store. By the time I was 5, they still had not let up much and had become adventurous in their choice of arenas. I was old enough to lift from sleep and bundle into the back seat of their old Nash. They would range the mountain on moonlit nights, and when they found a spot that was inviting, they simply stopped the Nash, made sure I was asleep, and got out and did it under the cold smile of the moon. The old chain-hung bridge over Tolliver's Creek was daunting even in daylight. It hung a good 50 feet in midair over the white, rushing water below. But it must have swayed gently and irresistibly before them that June night, because they parked the Nash on the far side and went off onto the middle of the bridge and took off their clothes and began to make love. And it was in the final blinded and deafened transports of love that Leon Crouch, drunk in his father's chicken truck, caromed onto the bridge and smashed them off it and onto the granite rapids below. I did not hear the truck coming. I did not hear it hit them. I only heard, an instant later, the squall of brakes and Leon Crouch shouting over and over, "Holy shit! Oh, holy shit, fire Jesus Lord!" And then, when he found me in the back seat of the Nash, "God damn those trashy fuckers! Right in front of their baby!" It was as good an epitaph as any for Rose Ellen and Cornelius Compton in the eyes of the mountain. Trinity College crowns the flat summit of Morgan's Mountain in South Tennessee like a mortarboard. It was modeled after the venerable Anglican colleges of England. The education is inalterably classical liberal arts and generally first-rate in spite of it. The Trinity experience no longer fits one to live anywhere but Trinity, it's often said at faculty doings. But those who remain do not wish to leave. Much of Trinity's power lies in its beauty. The mountain and the village of Montview are almost phantasmagorical in their loveliness. There are, to me, no mountains on earth so beautiful as these. They are among the oldest in the world, smoothed now to the curves of a sleeping woman's body. Trinity is eccentric and elitist and chauvinistic and innocent and arrogant and very, very particular. My grandfather Cash was a janitor there. He used to clean the structure that bore my other grandfather's name. Not for long. Papaw Cash refused to enter Compton Seminary with his mops and brooms once the Compton of it entered his family. Everyone at Trinity understood. Joe was powerfully attracted to my family's bizarre history. "It's pure American tragedy," he said over and over. "It's all of folklore and literature, really. The Montagues and the Capulets. Most of Faulkner." I was in Joe's senior literature seminar. It was how we met. He knew the story of my provenance. Everyone at Trinity did. I had stopped minding long before. Such was Trinity's ecclesiastical, liberal artsy predilection for wounded birds that I was a campus favorite from the days I used to come to work with my grandfather Cash and sat docilely on the steps of whatever structure he was cleaning, Mamaw Cash being practically certifiable by then. Somehow, I never felt an outsider in the domain, and I suppose that I was an appealing child. I heard it often. I was slight and grave and long-limbed, and had a cap of curls like a little Greek boy's, only fair and fine, thin features. I looked for all the world like my father, and still do, save for the very dark eyes that were my mother's. After a while, Mrs. Pierce, the provost's wife, put her foot down and said that it was a disgrace for Bishop Compton's great-granddaughter to sit out on the steps with the mops and brooms all day, and brought me into her own house. I pretty much grew up there weekdays. I went up to the little Trinity kindergarten, and then Montview Day. I know that my Compton grandparents paid my tuition and probably kicked in a good bit more in those earliest days. I know that if they'd sent money to my Cash grandparents' house, Mamaw Cash would have given it all to her church. She was practically handling snakes by that time. I never knew why my grandparents were so cold and angry. It was not entirely at my father and mother's shameful death, for they were silent and angry before that. My grandmother was a religious fanatic from the day she was converted by a hellfire-screaming, circuit-riding preacher near her 16th birthday. By the time my grandfather began taking me to work with him, she was so deeply possessed by the Holy Ghost that even he, stone-cold man that he was himself, feared she would harm me if I were left alone with her. She murdered one of Papaw's two prized heifers because her God demanded of her, one steaming July day, the sacrifice of a fatted calf. Then she went after the social worker from the county who heard about the calf and came to see how I was faring. Only the intervention of the pastor of her church and my grandfather's promise to keep me away from her saved her from being committed then and there to the state mental facility in Knoxville. The next morning, I went for the first time up the winding road to Trinity College with my grandfather in his old truck, and passed for the first time under the arch and into the domain. Yes, that small part of me deep inside whispered, "This is right. This is the place." I told Joe everything about me soon after we met, except the manner of my parents' death. I told him finally, on a day when he asked me to go with him down off the mountain and over to Chattanooga to hear an organ concert in one of the big Episcopal churches there. "I have all the God up here I need," I said finally. "I don't need a dose of anybody else's." "Cat," Joe said, "why don't you leave this mountain? What are you afraid of?" And so I told him. And he wept. And I knew then that I would marry him if he would ask me, and that he probably would. And he did, not long after that day. I fell in love with him on the first day of his seminar, in the winter of my senior year. His eyes were blue and full of a kind of swimming light behind the round wire glasses, and his features were narrow and sharp and tanned. We had heard that he was considered a great asset to Trinity.
"My name is Joe Gilliard," he said. "Josiah Peabody Gilliard. The Josiah and the Peabody are Vermont Yankee from back to Adam, but the Gilliard is a Cajun merchant marine who met my mother in Boston on her high school class trip and married her 3 hours before I was born. I just figured I'd get things off on the right foot and let you guys know you didn't have the lock on Gothic down here."
We laughed, and I was lost. I married him on the afternoon of my graduation from Trinity, in austere little St. Rhoda's Chapel. I wore a simple white eyelet dress that Cora Pierce had married in, and wildflowers from the steep in my hair, and Joe wore his Dartmouth hood over his Trinity gown.
Student-faculty relations were forbidden, but Joe was Trinity's first golden boy from the Ivy League, and I was their poster child. And Joe melted any incipient resistance by simply going to Dr. Pierce, still our provost and my unofficial guardian since the death of both sets of my grandparents, and formally declaring his honorable intentions toward me. I had been living with the Pierces since my Cash grandparents died in the final fire set in the old house by Mad Maddie Cash when I was 13. I truly loved the gentle, childless old couple who had plucked me off a stone doorstep all those years ago, and knew they loved me in return. They had become the grandparents the Comptons might have been to me if I could have made myself leave the mountain. But even at 13, the dread of the outside world that was born on Tolliver's Creek was too vivid, too real for that. I had made one visit to their home just after Papa and Mama died, and the anxiety of it was so overwhelming that I trembled and vomited for 3 days, only stopping when I passed once more under the arch into the domain. It was then that the suggestion was first made, by my grandmother Compton, that perhaps a discreet stint of psychiatric therapy would not be amiss. "It's not you," I said into my grandmother's lilac-smelling neck. "You know I love you and Grandpa. It's just that I have to be up here. I have to be." "Then, my dear cat, you shall be," she said, and hugged me hard and went into the Pierce's house with Grandpa Compton to talk with Dr. and Mrs. Pierce about the matter. After that, I saw my Compton grandparents regularly, but always it was at Trinity. I left the mountain only for infrequent,
reluctant shopping and academic field trips to nearby Chattanooga or Knoxville or Nashville, and very rarely Atlanta, and I left under the serene kiss of a tranquilizer administered by the college physician, an old friend of the Pierces. Even then, anxiety curled like a snake in the pit of my stomach, dormant but sentient. By the time I met Joe, I had not been off the mountain in over a year. I was planning, after graduation, to take a position at Trinity as a graduate assistant in the art department. It was a beautiful little wedding, if I do say so, with a spare sweetness to it. The few contemporaries of mine who attended often speak of it. Even Joe's friend Corrine Parker, then a cynical, foul-mouthed, and thoroughly engaging graduate assistant in the psych department, and now a successful psychologist with a practice in Montview, was touched by the ceremony. "It almost made me wish I was straight," she said not long after the wedding, at the first party we gave in our tiny rented guest cottage. "I yearned for White Islet for a week afterwards." Corrine was a lesbian and lived openly with another gay woman. Nobody particularly cared. One's sexuality has never been of much concern at Trinity. "You could have White Islet if you wanted," Joe said, ruffling her short copper thatch. "I'd look like a fire plug with a tea napkin slung over it," Corrine snarled. Corrine said to me once, a few years after Lacey was born, "I know it isn't any of my business, Cat, but if you ever feel like talking to someone about this agoraphobic stuff, I think I could help you." I hugged her and said, "Rennie, I'm not agoraphobic. I'm just exactly where I want to be. But thanks anyway." And she smiled and hugged me back. She never mentioned it again, but sometimes at parties at our house, she looks at me thoughtfully, and I know what she's thinking. Joe's mother was bedridden with emphysema, and his father had been dead for some years, but his older brother and sister, Caleb and Sarah, came to the wedding. I liked them, but I think they found the mountain a bit precious after the rocky harshness of their Vermont farm. They stayed overnight at the inn and left early the next day, with invitations to come and stay with them in Vermont. Somehow I knew I would not go. I didn't think Joe did, though, not then.
"You'll get to know them better," he said, "when we go up for you to meet Ma."
"I wish she could have been here," I said, the old familiar fear starting up in the pit of my stomach. We had not spoken before of leaving the mountain to go and visit his mother. We had not spoken of leaving it at all. We had made love for the first time the night before. It was the first time ever for me.
"Remarkable," Joe said, "in that age of mandatory egalitarian sexuality among the young." "I can see why you never have, with your parents and all," he said the first time we talked about it.
From the beginning, it was hard for us to keep our hands off each other, and we both sensed that some sort of policy about sex had to be arrived at. "I'm not scared," I said, and I believed it. "The reason I don't do it is because I never met anybody I wanted to do it with until you." But we did not consummate it. It would be even sweeter for the waiting. And it was the right thing for us. And so we gasped and burned and fumbled along until our wedding day. And the instant we went upstairs to our room in the inn, we slammed and locked our door and looked at each other and then skinned out of our wedding clothes and ran into each other's arms. We did not even make it to the bed. After the first time, we did it twice more before we even got up off the floor. I loved it. I always have. I knew that it was so for Joe, too. I knew by the way he laughed aloud, a whoop like a boy's, after it was done.
For myself, I found that I could make no sound. Not that first time, and never since, could I so much as whisper, whimper, cry out, or laugh. I could feel the sound welling up in me as he filled me and rocked me. But I could force no sound out. At first it puzzled Joe, and then alarmed him slightly, and finally became a challenge, a matter of honor, a slight. We finally made a small joke of it, and were able to move past it. "It's just," I laughed one summer afternoon as we lay on the grass in the shady lee of our garden wall, "that I want to be able to hear you coming." Neither of us said anything. I knew I had gone to the literal heart of my silence. In that last lost moment, I needed more than anything on earth to be able to hear whatever was coming, so that I could not, like my parents, die of my love. Exactly, Joe said quietly. Exactly, my poor cat. After that, he seemed content with my silence. In an odd way, it seemed even to please him. It was a confirmation of that first seductive, gothic strangeness that had drawn him to me. For all my life, I have wondered about Joe's fascination with the South. I think it had its genesis in that stark, rock-spined farm in the northeast corner of Vermont. It was not much of a farm ever, and his father's early defection and death, added to his mother's chronic illness, bled it into near poverty. Joe worked the farm before and after school and in the summers. He worked in silence and studied with furious, focused concentration. He remembered that the only music and laughter and dancing he had ever known had come from the South, with his dimly remembered father. His grades were awesome, and his SATs struck his teachers into silence. When he chose Dartmouth and said goodbye to his mother and Caleb and Sarah, everyone understood that it was a long goodbye. After a few bad days and weeks following his promise to Caleb and Sarah to bring me north to meet his mother, I did not really fear that Joe would try to move off the mountain and take me with him. That first summer in the little stone guest house we rented, I started the first of the gardens for which I have become modestly renowned, and began the series of small evenings of food and drink and talk which have become Trinity traditions. I began to lay down a life for Joe that was so ordered and fulfilling and rich in substance that he would not miss the benison of scope. Just for insurance, I covertly threw into the college incinerator, on the second day of my marriage, the little round cardboard wheel of Innovids the college physician had given me. I knew past all doubt the exact moment that I got pregnant, and knew the next April, when our daughter Lacey was born blind, that I was safe forever. We would not leave the mountain now. If Lacey was to live without sight, she would live at least in Eden. The world that kept me safe would keep her, too. On an evening nearly 21 years later, we sat in a garden identical save in scope to that first one, having our drinks in the cool spring twilight and reading a letter from our daughter in college, a continent away. She had written to tell us that she was going to Europe with friends that summer, to backpack through Spain and Italy and the south of France, and hoped we might join her afterwards to travel in Yugoslavia. "I hear that Dubrovnik is the most beautiful city in the world," she wrote in her dark, angular letters on the paper with the raised, lined grids that she used. "I wish you'd come to be my eyes." Joe put the letter down and looked out over the stone wall, spilling white clematis now into empty blue air above the lip of the steep. Our house commanded the whole valley like a fortress. He did not speak, but I knew what he was thinking. My throat tightened at my daughter's cheerful valor and my own crippling cowardice. "We should go," I said, around a great geyser of fear, in a voice that was not mine. "She's right. There just isn't any reason not to. This is silly. Enough is enough." "I wouldn't do that to you, Cat," Joe said, and there was nothing in his voice but the old love. "It would be like putting a gun to your head and pulling the trigger. What do you think I am?" "A 50-year-old man who's never been to Europe," I said, and got up and went into the house and called Corrine Parker. "There are these bands of gypsy children who roam the streets like packs of orphan puppies. They dress in rags and come up to you in tears, begging for money, and while your heart is breaking, one of them slips around behind you and picks your pocket. They're all over Rome." Hayes Bennett, who was president of the faculty council, took a deep swallow of his gin and tonic and grinned his vulpine grin around the room. Of all our friends, I was least comfortable with Hayes. He was the only one of our usual party crowd who teased me about never leaving the mountain, and he did it often enough so that I did not think it was casual or coincidental. He was looking at me now. I knew that the story of the gypsy children was aimed like an arrow at me. Colin and Marie had just asked Joe and me to meet them in Rome in July, where they were to be married. Now everyone at our party had been babbling in excitement over the proposed trip. My silence had not escaped Hayes. "They sound awful," I said lightly.
"Oh, they never hurt anybody," Hayes said. "They're after your money, not your life. Not like on the San Diego freeway. Would you rather be mugged or murdered than surprised?"
"Cat would," Joe said lazily from the sofa, where he was sprawled with his bourbon and soda. I turned to look at him in surprise, and the sort of swift, small shock of hurt you feel when a beloved child or pet lashes out at you. "Almost I would," I said, smiling. "Death before stealth." The small group in the living room laughed.
"Who wouldn't? There's no redeeming social value in being scared to death," Corinne Parker said, grinning slightly and looking closely at me, and the moment in the party flowed on.
It was a pretty party, a good one. I knew that I had a knack for bringing people together in easy groups, and I had honed it by determination and repetition into an art. Joe loved being a host. It pleased him to please people, and he was as house-proud as only someone who has lived meanly in his childhood can be. I wanted none of Joe's hungers to go unfed. I wanted his needs to be met entirely in the house on the steep and the school on the mountain. I thought I had succeeded, but his lazy words tonight spoke from some unfulfilled emptiness I had not suspected, and I was frightened. I looked at him again. He was very handsome, still as lean and sinewy, still as knobbly graceful as the first day I saw him. I looked at my husband in the light of the copper lamps, and for a moment did not know him.
"Dinner in 15 minutes, I said, and got up and went into the downstairs bathroom and stood at the mirror over the wash basin.
"That better be you," I said. It was, but there was something different. I was still me, but more so, or maybe me, but less. I had been in therapy with Corinne Parker for almost exactly 2 years. I started the week after we got the letter from Lacey asking us to go to Yugoslavia with her. We had not gone. I did not think Lacey really expected us to. In the end, she persuaded one of her companions to stay on in Europe and go across the Adriatic with her, and Joe and I stayed at home and read her letters with joy for her and no more overt regret for ourselves. But I had been determined that I would never see in Joe's eyes again a yearning for something that I held him back from, and I worked with Corinne as I have never worked at anything else. I trembled and sweated and wept, and once or twice I threw up in Corinne's neat little bathroom. I gulped Valium like candy for a while, and lost sleep and weight, and railed at her and cried endlessly when I thought Joe could not hear me. Before, I had been Cat who could not go off the mountain. Now, I was Cat who could. I looked in the mirror at Cat who could go, and knew in that moment that I had grown, and Joe feared that. And it was from that fear that he had spoken tonight. Corinne had seen, and tried to make me see, but I would not, could not. "Well, then," she said to me in exasperation finally, after nearly a year of arguing with me about Joe's role in my recovery, "I don't think you realize how deeply all this is threatening Joe. He's capable of sabotaging everything. He wouldn't think he was doing that, of course. He'd think he was protecting you." "Corinne," I said, "I think you are probably the best therapist this side of Vienna, but if you say one more word to me about Joe, I'm going to terminate. I mean it."
"You're right," Corinne said. "It was the friend that was talking and not the therapist. I'm sorry, Cat. It was way too soon."
I let it go. In fact, I buried it deep and forgot it. Or thought I had. Finally, midway in the second year of therapy, I began to make trips off the mountain with Corinne. Tiny ones, at first. Really, just drives to the base of the mountain and back up. I was wet with sweat and tears when we got back, and so weak I had to go home and lie down. But I could do it. Soon, I was driving my car, and she was in the passenger seat, and we began to drive farther and stay longer. On the day we drove all the way to Atlanta without my taking a single Valium, Corrine announced that it was time for me to take a few trips without her.
Get Joe to go with you. Surely he knows how important this is to you, how hard you've worked.
I haven't told him about the trips, I said, not meeting her eyes.
She said nothing.
When I asked him, he would not go.
I just can't, sweetie, he said the first time. Midterm is the worst possible time for me. Next quarter.
Early the next quarter, he brought a world-famous poet to campus. In March, he sprained his ankle playing tennis. I took a triple dose of Valium and made the trip by myself, in a white haze of sedation and terror. The second trip I made on two Valiums. My third trip, I only took one. I told neither Joe nor Corrine. In late April, Corrine wanted Joe and me to go away somewhere for a weekend off the mountain.
Go to a fancy hotel in Atlanta, she said, grinning. Order room service and screw your heads off.
I laughed and made the reservations that afternoon. That night over drinks, I told Joe about it. He did not speak, and he did not look at me.
I just don't think we should both be away at the same time, Cat, he said finally. What if Lacey wanted to come home all of a sudden? Wouldn't you want to be here for Lacey?
I told Corrine about it.
I'm only going to make one speech, Cat, and if you need to terminate because of it, so be it. I think this whole thing is about control. Up here, you can control your world, and what a world you've made. It's orderly, it's serene, it's beautiful. Very few people on Earth can live like you and Joe do, and almost no one can do it except in places like this, in the famous domain. I don't think it's safety you're afraid of losing. I think it's specialness. Up here, you're not just a housewife, you're a domainian. And Joe is not just an English professor, he's head of the English department in the domain, on the mountain. You think he wants you to go running down to the flatland and leaving Eden? Hell no. Go by yourself, because if you don't go now, I don't think you ever will.
It was a long speech for Corrine, and her square figure was taut with the passion of it. What if Lacey did, for some reason, want to come home? I said in a small voice, knowing how ridiculous I sounded.
Cat, Lacey isn't going to come home again, Corrine said. You've worked hard enough to see that she didn't have to, and you succeeded.
Yes, I whispered. I know she isn't. And I turned and walked out of Corrine's office. I did not go back, but I'll never forget what she did for me. When Lacey was born, I think I sensed something was wrong from the first instant I held her. It could have been so much worse, I said to Joe, trying to comfort him in his anguish. It could have been something that would hurt her, cause her pain.
Christ, Cat, you think this isn't going to cause her pain? You know how the world treats blind people, like retards. Well, then she just won't go out into the world, I said savagely. She'll stay on the mountain with us. It's a wonderful life. She'll hardly know she's without sight. You're glad, aren't you? Now you'll never have to leave.
I merely looked at him, holding my baby. I'm sorry, Cat, he whispered, his face crumpling. Forgive me. It's just, I wish I could exchange my eyes for hers. We kept her at home. It was Joe's decision as much as mine, perhaps even more so. Lacey was fearless and pragmatic to a degree that simply astounded me, who am neither. If she fell, she picked herself up and toddled on. We padded corners and tried our best to treat her as a normal child. She was light years ahead of us in that respect. She talked early and volubly, and her memory was phenomenal. Corrine told us that her IQ was probably astonishing.
She doesn't have to live with limits, Corrine said early on. With her intelligence and temperament, she can probably have almost any life she wants. There are special schools that can help her live just about as normally as any child. She's going to stay here, Joe said. We're going to teach her. She'll have everything she needs. She needs the real world, Joe, Corrine said.
This is her real world, he said.
Who wouldn't love growing up in this place? Nobody's going to think of her as a blind kid here. She is a blind kid,
Corrine said. She needs to go through and past that. So do you two. After that talk, he simply would not speak of Lacey to Corrine. Lacey stayed on the mountain with us in our little house and walled garden, and was taught Braille and simple coping skills by the young tutor who came each day. Joe and I spent virtually all our time with her. Somehow, we managed not to spoil her. I really think her own sunniness and enormous curiosity saw to that. I was proud and grateful that we had managed to fashion a world for our child that made sight virtually unnecessary. When she was 10, Joe and I began to plan the house we wanted to live in for the rest of our lives. We finally bought a lot, the back 4 acres of an old estate on the very lip of the steep. We had Philip, an architect friend, translate our ideas into drawings, and on the night we sat down with him to review them, Lacey sat with us, her head against Joe's knees. "I see it as a house without boundaries," Philip said, "as a place where you won't know where you leave off and the woods and sky start. This is a nice starter house, kids, but these little rooms are like living in shoeboxes, like a little rabbit warren." Lacey began to scream. Within seconds, she was hysterical and so near breathlessness that we had to call her pediatrician. It was only after much holding and rocking that we got words out of her. Lacey was afraid she would fall out of her new house into thin air, and Philip's words about the only house she had ever known had simply devastated her. "That's not how they are," she said of the rooms he had described as shoeboxes. "That's not how it looks. This house is beautiful. I won't leave here." It was the first time I had realized that the world Lacey had built for herself behind her eyes was far grander, more beautiful than anything on the earth could be. What had she for comparison? It was the first time that I saw clearly what we were doing to her by keeping her on the mountain, away from the rest of the world. I went to see Corrine Parker the next morning. By that fall, Lacey was enrolled in the long-term children's rehabilitation center at the Cleveland Sight Center. When she went away in September, it was Joe who went with her, not me. "She's already afraid," Corrine said. "It's inevitable with her intuition that she'll catch your fear of leaving and think she's going into danger out there. Let Joe take her." "Don't cry, Cat. This is best, and it's high time. Her real life starts now." It was the right thing, of course. Lacey learned prodigiously. She ate learning as if it were food, and she starving. She embraced the world, with all its stenches and grime and danger and meanness, and all its simple glories. She had all the tools, the clicker that helps her by its resonances to gauge depths and positions, the white cane, the computer, and the wonderful dogs with whom she could walk almost as easily in the world as the sighted. Yes, it was the right thing that Lacey was in the world of her choosing, and Joe and I were in the house of our dreams in the world of our choosing. I reached up and touched the nose of the woman in the mirror. "Nothing is different. Not really," I said to her. She did not look entirely convinced. I bit my lips to redden them, a trick I had learned reading Gone with the Wind, and went back to my party. Colin Girard was Joe's protege, the heir apparent. Colin was from an old Richmond family, and he slipped as easily into the world on the mountain as if he had been born there, handsome in a must-find-bone way, funny in the self-deprecating way that is so admired up here, bright to near brilliance. When I think of the words golden boy, I think of Colin Girard. How on earth he had come to be so besotted with Maria Vaccaro's Condon from Newark, New Jersey, has been a source of much speculation. Maria came to Trinity on full scholarship to study political science and met Colin during her freshman year when he was a junior. There is no explaining chemistry. She is dark and dumpy and short and wild-haired, so large-breasted as to be a campus joke. She is awesomely smart. Her grades outshone even Colin's. Colin absolutely adores her. No one is crass enough to say that she is common, but the word somehow lingers in the air when she is in a group. I like her, and I like Colin much better for loving her. Tonight, Colin has announced that he and Maria decided to be married in Rome over the coming 4th of July. And, he said, grinning around the room, there was going to be a dinner the night before in Trastevere, to which we were all invited, if we could manage it, given by Sam Forrest in his rooftop garden. There was a soft explosion of sound. Sam Forrest, an American expatriate living in Italy for years, a painter of such renown and charm that hardly a glossy magazine managed an issue without some mention of him and his beautiful wife, Ada. His huge canvases, flaming with body color and a kind of elegant savagery, hung in every important museum in the world. His talent was immense and real.
"Did you win the wedding in a contest?"
Hayes Bennett said.
"Actually, Hayes, he's family," Colin said. His smile was creamy with satisfaction. "Maria's. He's her uncle or something, by marriage. Isn't that something? Even I didn't know, and then she hands me this letter from him."
We all looked at Maria. She dropped her eyes. "It sounds like bragging," she muttered.
"So, anyway, you're all invited, and Maria and I want to issue a formal invitation to Joe and Kat to come with us and be our attendants and drive with us through Tuscany. Go on our honeymoon with us. Is that tacky or what? How about it, Joe?"
The group fell silent. Joe did not speak. I felt Hayes' eyes on me.
"Let's do it," I said, my heart buckling like a wild thing under my silk shirt. "Let's just do it."
God, I'd love to, but we couldn't," Joe said. "Cat couldn't."
"Oh, yes,"
Corinne Parker said.
"Cat could."
"Could you?" Joe looked at me. Everything that was unsaid shimmered in the air between us.
"Yes,"
I said.
"Then," Joe said, smiling, "we will."
About an hour into a thick, heavy sleep, after a barely touched steak dinner and an unwatched movie, I woke with a heart-pounding sense of a missed appointment. I looked around at the silent, darkened cabin of the huge jet. Joe was twisted against my shoulder. I had the strong feeling that I alone was awake in the plane. It was the loneliest feeling, but I did not waken Joe. I sat and tasted the sensation to see what would come. Not much did. Soon even the chilly loneliness crept back somewhere inside me, and I could feel only the slight elemental buzz in my veins of the double dose of tranquilizer I had swallowed as we left the mountain.
"You okay?" Joe would ask me at one juncture or another. He wore chinos and a polo shirt the color of his eyes, and carried an old blue blazer over his shoulder. Unlike almost everyone else on our flight, he carried no hand luggage, not even a camera.
"I'm great," I would say, smiling through the lovely, deep surge of my sedated blood. I tried to sit very still and empty my mind for whatever would come. The intercom made a frying, crackling sound, and the pilot came on. "There was," he said, "a line of rather violent thunderstorms coming across the Alps. Things would," he said, "be a little turbulent." Before he finished his sentence, we hit it. Since I had never been in a plane before, I had nothing with which to compare that 10 or so minutes. But Joe talked of it for a long time afterward. The plane would drop sickeningly, then be tossed horizontally, drop and buck and yaw. Some of the drop seemed endless, and people stopped gasping and explaining and fell deadly silent. Soon, at each great lurch, there would be stifled screams, and I heard sobs of fear all around me. I clutched Joe's arm and shut my eyes and braced myself. We fell abruptly out of the clouds into slanting rain, and red earth and round green hillocks rose up rapidly to meet us. The intercom crackled again, and the unseen pilot told us that the tower had talked us down. The entire plane erupted into applause. There is probably no way to prepare a first-timer for Rome. I literally stumbled and half fell into the roaring, jostling airport. Only Joe's hand on the back of my blazer and the press of passengers ahead saved me. I took a deep breath and looked around. "Why is it so dark?" I asked Joe. The great space of the airport was not only dim, it was stifling hot. Something felt very wrong. "There are machine guns all over the place," Joe whispered in my ear. "That guy on the balcony has one trained on us." I looked up. On the gallery overlooking the main level where we were, a whip-thin young guard in a tightly tailored uniform stood, a sleekly evil machine gun at waist level. "Joe, what is this?" I said in an airless whisper. "I don't know." Then, up and down the line, we heard a word we did not know, but that seemed to put our fellow passengers at ease. "Chopero." We heard snorts of disgust and one or two bursts of laughter. "Mi scusi," Joe said to the tweedy man ahead of me. "Che cosa significa? Chopero."
"It's another strike," he said. "The electricity this time. There's one of some kind about every 15 minutes. At least the taxis and buses will still be running. The Uzis are just because the lights are out, and you never know when that happens in Italy."
By the time we cleared customs, the twilight murk still lingered. My stockings and underwear were damp with sweat, and my skirt stuck to me. "A shower is going to feel like heaven," I said.
"Now aren't you sorry about what you called the poor old Cavaliere Hilton?" Joe said, grinning. "At least you can be sure a Hilton will have a shower and air conditioning."
There were no bags in the motionless luggage carousel. They had been piled to one side. We eventually captured my one large bag and two small totes. Joe reached for his, frowned, and straightened up.
"That's not my bag," he said. "It's just like mine, but it doesn't have my identification tag on it."
We looked again, but his bag was not there.
"Oh, good Christ," he said tiredly.
It was obvious someone with a bag identical to his had taken Joe's home. There was no identification by which we might trace the owner. I thought of the rooftop rehearsal dinner at the Forests in less than 4 hours, and my own two best dresses, which I had tucked into Joe's suitcase. We dragged the bag over to the baggage master's cubicle. He was very cordial, but...
"Che posso fare?"
What could he do? When we reached the pavement outside at last, it was 5:30, and the first fresh breath of air of the Eternal City smote my face and neck like a belch of a blast furnace. Wordlessly, we crawled into the first cab in the line, and Joe said,
"Hotel Cavaliere Hilton, per favore."
The careening, squealing, honking, pounding, brake-screeching trip took fully an hour and 3/4. Later, we learned that our driver had without doubt taken us via as long a route as possible. Finally, after a twisting ascent up a suburban mountain, the entire city lay below me, spread out on its hills, brown and umber and copper and alabaster, bathed in a clear gray-gold light that seemed to spring out of the very earth and air. And in the middle of it all rose the great luminous dome of St. Peter's. And I began to cry. Oh, Italy. The first time I ever come down off my own mountain, and it was to this. Joe laid his arm around my shoulder and patted it, and I knew that he was praying that I was not beginning some sort of terrible, escalating attack of the panic. I squeezed his hand to show him that it was not the fear. We screeched to a rocking stop at the Cavaliere Hilton. Joe jerked himself out of the taxi and began to scramble furiously in his coat pocket for his wallet. A shower of crumpled bills and a spray of silver shot out at the feet of the uniformed doorman. He and the taxi driver pounced on the booty. Joe turned red and then deadly white. I fled into the haven of the huge, ornate glacial lobby.
An hour later, we were in another taxi, winding down the mountain road we had just caromed up. After buying Joe 2 form-fitting shirts of some silky material from the appallingly priced men's shop off the lobby, we just had time to shower and leave again for Trastevere. I wore a flowered cotton sundress more suited for a morning in Florida than an engagement party, but I did not care what I wore. Joe, in the stylish Roman shirt, did.
"I feel like I should have on a stretch satin Speedo bikini under my pants," he said.
We could not see much of the panorama. The sky had darkened to violet, but few lights had come on yet. We reached the bottom of the mountain and turned. I knew from the narrow turning streets and the crumbling plaster houses leaning over them that we were in a very old part of Rome. The driver swung the car through an arched gate and into an even narrower, darker street. He slowed and stopped. Joe and I looked at each other.
"Via Lungara?" Joe said.
His voice echoed thinly in the silence.
Number 10? Dieci?
The driver nodded and pointed. Joe paid him, and he rolled silently away down the ancient street.
"Well," Joe said briskly, "third door down on the left. Let's go."
He took my hand, and we picked our way down the crazed and cobbled old street, peering into doorways. We came to the third one, as dead and sealed as the rest. Joe raised his hand to knock and then let it fall.
"Was it third?" he said. "Or fourth?"
The old fear and the afternoon's tears surged back up into my throat. I knew that in a moment I was going to begin to sob with terror. The door flew open and yellow light streamed out into the street and over us, and a man's deep voice, rich with the music of my own South, called,
"Come in this house!"
And I ran straight into the outstretched arms of Sam Forrest as a small animal might into its burrow, or a child to home. That night I got drunk with Sam Forrest. If it had been any other night or any other place, it would have been an evening I remembered with radiant shame for the rest of my life. But at the time, it seemed entirely the thing to do, and it still does. I believe that Sam Forrest saved my life that night. He was a massive man, with arms and legs like trunks of small trees, and hands that seemed as large and perfectly modeled as Michelangelo's sculptures. He was all over freckles. His hair was thick and grizzled, and he wore it tied back in a ponytail. He wore a wrinkled white shirt open nearly to the waist and chinos. He smelled of thin, raw gin and acrid cigarette smoke, and ripe, powerful sweat.
"I have your view of Gahanna. It was the first signed print I ever bought," I babbled, looking busily up at him. "I'm Catherine Compton. God, I mean, Gilliard. Did anyone ever tell you you look like Errol Flynn? I mean, if he were bigger?"
And my voice trailed off, and I felt heat rising from my chest to my hairline.
"Shit," I said.
Sam Forrest laughed, a great wind of sound.
"As a matter of fact, somebody once wrote that I looked like an Errol Flynn balloon at the Macy's Thanksgiving Parade," he said.
"I'm Joe Gilliard, the man who accompanied Cat Compton to Rome," Joe said. His voice was his school one, cool and amused.
"I figured," Sam said. "Maria said to look for a man who was the spit and image of Ashley Wilkes, only in seersucker. In this neighborhood, that could only be you, minus the seersucker, of course."
I heard the stiffness in Joe's voice as he said, "It would be seersucker if I could have helped it. Some fool took my bag at the airport. I had to buy what I could find at the hotel."
"Well,"
Sam Forrest said, turning,
"come on up. The party's just getting going, and Colin and Maria are fairly twitching to see you."
We followed him through the dimly lit courtyard. "Here's the elevator," Sam Forrest said. For what seemed like endless minutes, we stood pressed close together in the dingy cell. And then the door squealed open, and we stepped out into the midst of the party on Sam's rooftop. I gasped.
I had never seen anything so perfectly lovely, so exotic, so totally beyond expectation as that candle-lit rooftop. Loose summer bouquets were jammed into vases and pottery jars. The candles were set simply in unmatched sticks, saucers, and hurricanes. Music spilled like liquid from a little radio on the wide parapet. Vivaldi. People laughed and talked quietly. And all around, like the sea seen from the bottom, Rome, floodlit and pulsing. A woman detached herself from the crowd and came toward us. At first I thought she was an albino, she was so pale. Her face and hair were almost of the same pearled white, and she wore white silk, too. Her mouth was a slash of scarlet in all the gleaming whiteness. By the time she reached us, I saw that she was very beautiful. "I made a forest," she said. "Welcome to Rome and to our party. We've been hearing all about you." There was no trace of any accent in her light voice. She leaned over and kissed me, and kissed Joe, too.
"It is entirely my pleasure to meet you," Joe said.
I knew that he was as dazzled by Ada Forrest as I was. Ada drew us toward the group on the roof. Before they turned to greet us, I looked at them. Almost every woman there wore something silken or tight, in hectic scarlet or black or white. I felt, I thought, exactly like what I was, a middle-aged woman in a teenager's dress. Then Maria burst out of the group and ran and threw her arms around us, and Colin was there and hugging us, and we moved into the body of the party. Except for Ada Forrest and one dark, languid woman, none were Italian. We met many Americans, but the essential gulf between them and me seemed written in neon in the humid air. Rightness seemed to seep out of their very pores, just as otherness did from mine. Even Maria and Colin, once they hugged us and introduced us around the group, drifted off, twined around each other. "Let's get a drink," I said to Joe, and my voice sounded high and artificial in my own ears. "What can I get you?" the young bartender said. "Bourbon and water," I said, and he looked embarrassed. "I don't think we have any of that," he said. "There's some scotch, though, and some brandy." "Make it a brandy," I said. "Over ice." "Campari and soda," Joe said. I simply stared at him. Joe always drinks bourbon. I swallowed my brandy at one gulp and handed the glass back for a refill. "Christ, Cat," Joe said under his voice. "Somehow this just doesn't seem the perfect place to get drunk." I drank down the second brandy, and the fear receded a little. "Just don't leave me," I whispered to Joe. "I won't," he said, and smiled, and more of the strangeness shrank back. But he did. In a few minutes, Colin Gerard called out,
"Hey, Joe! Come over here and tell these ignoramuses what Trastevere's greatest poet said about the Trasteverinos."
Joe smiled and let his arm drop from around my shoulders and walked away from me toward the group. I could not seem to make my feet move.
"Would you like another brandy, ma'am?" the young bartender said.
"Yes, thank you." He poured it and I sipped, grateful for the fire that flowed into my empty stomach. From across the roof, I heard Joe's lazy school voice saying,
"Well, if memory serves, an expatriate like yourself said of Rome, it's as good a place as any to wait for the end of the world." I think it was in Fellini's Roma.
Colin laughed, but no one else did.
I believe it was Gore Vidal who said it,
Joe added into the silence. No one responded. My heart squeezed with anguish for my beautiful, brilliant husband, drowning in his pedantry like a fish in the air on this hateful roof.
"Did he really say that?" one of the women said, a tall blonde in a short black leather skirt. "It doesn't sound like Gore. I play tennis with him when he's in Rome. I'll ask him." "Maybe it wasn't Vidal," Joe said, and smiled and shrugged.
The smile looked as though it had been cut into his face with broken glass.
I banged the glass down on the bar and started towards Joe.
At that moment, Ada Forrest came as smoothly out of the shadows as a white shark and took his arm and bore him over to the other side of the room. She pointed to something down below and whispered in his ear. I saw him throw back his head and laugh, and she laughed, too, a rich sound, like tawny port. I was grateful to Ada Forrest to hear the all-rightness in my husband's laugh. They sank into two of the chairs that faced the city and began to talk. No one was looking at me. I took my drink over to the carved stone bench against the parapet. The fear erupted from the deepest core of me, filling me up to the ends of my hair shafts. I had never felt such sucking terror before. I closed my eyes. I felt the brandy glass fall from my suddenly dead fingers. I felt myself sway. Someone put a hand on my shoulder.
I would be extremely pleased if you would do me the honor of sitting here on this bench with me and getting drunk, Sam Forrest said. He had two glasses in one hand and a bottle of bourbon in the other.
I keep a bottle in reserve for very special occasions, he said. Not too many people have the innate class to ask for it.
I was glad to hear you did. Neat or with water?
Neat, I said. My voice sounded normal, I thought.
He poured two glasses of the bourbon. Here's to the start of a beautiful friendship, he said.
He drank his bourbon down quickly, and so did I. Without asking, he filled both our glasses. Neither of us spoke for a small time. In the shadow, I could feel Sam Forrest looking at me. I turned and smiled. Tell me what you're working on now, I said.
He laughed. Right now I'm working on a hangover, he said. Aside from that, absolutely nothing. Not since this time last year. I thought I'd have it in gear by this spring, but I didn't, and now it's summer, and nobody can work in Rome in the summer for the tourists and the visitors stopping in to see what you're working on.
We should have thought of that, I said formally. Of course you can't work. Listen, Sam, please don't feel like you have to stay here and talk to me. I'm fine. Joe and I are really going to have to run in a minute.
I don't mean you, Cat, he said.
Christ, somebody should sew my mouth shut. I wouldn't be working if you and everybody else in Rome left me alone for the rest of my life. And I'm here drinking bourbon with you because there's nowhere else on this goddamn roof I'd rather be right now. You and Joe aren't going to have to run in a minute because Ada isn't going to let go of him.
I looked across the rooftop as Joe, his arm linked through Ada's, laughed and lifted his glass. I thought Joe was, indeed, going to be just fine.
We may get him home by morning at the rate he's going, I said, trying out a little laugh that ended in a hiccup.
Oh, Lord, excuse me. Do you work here at home?
No. I've got a studio and a house off the Campo Fiore.
I'll take you to see it while you're here, if you like.
I would, I said. Sam Forrest was very easy to talk to. I like it that you're a southerner, I said. It takes some of the curse off you being so famous. It makes you so easy to talk to.
Of course, being drunk makes it easy, too.
He laughed and patted my shoulder. I looked out over the rooftops of Trastevere and felt the alcohol singing in my blood. I don't know which is best, I said, being here now or remembering it later. He laughed and said,
"What are you afraid of, Cat?"
I turned to him, the word nothing on my lips, and then I said, "I'm afraid of everything. I'm afraid of almost everything in the world that isn't on the mountain at home, and I've been afraid since I was 5 years old."
"Tell me,"
he said, and I did. I told him all of it. It took quite a long time. "I know it's funny," I said, smiling.
"I don't think it's funny," Sam said. "I mean that. Listen, Cat, you mustn't be afraid of Rome. It's just too rich. There's too much you need to get here. You must take it all in. I bet it could heal you."
He looked at me for a time in the darkness, a small smile curving the thin bronze lips up.
"I'd like to do two things while you're in Rome, Cat Gilliard," he said. "I'd like to show you my Rome, and I'd like to draw you. Your face is all over Rome, you know. Will you let me do that?"
I don't know about the drawing, I said. After tonight, I'm going to have such a hangover that I won't be drawable for 10 years. But I'd like to see your Rome. Can Joe come, too?
Sure, he said.
Am I right in thinking that you and Joe are going with these Randy children on their honeymoon?
Yeah. Isn't that shameless? From here to Venice and then to Florence and then to the hill towns.
Ah, yes, he said. The hill towns. Get Cat back up into her hills. Meanwhile, have another drink.
We did. We had several more. It must have been very late when Joe, still attached to Ada Forrest's arm, came to claim me and take me home. All of a sudden, I realized that we were among the last people left on the Forrest's roof. It should have bothered me, but by then, nothing did. On my first morning in Rome, I slept late. It was 11 a.m., and Joe was shaking me by the shoulder and holding coffee to my nose. I thought for a moment that the dark, thick smell would make me throw up.
"Good morning, Signora," Joe said, setting the coffee on the bedside table and sitting down on the edge of the bed.
I grimaced with the pain of his touch and sat up. "Is there any water?" I croaked.
"There's some agua minerale," he said.
I reached out blindly for the glass and downed the mineral water in a gulp. It careened around my stomach and threatened for a moment to bounce right back up.
"Can you die of this?" I said.
"Not in Rome," Joe said. "If last night was any example, half of the Eternal City feels that way when they wake up. I've got a tad of a hangover myself." He brought the coffee back in a small plate with a hard roll and a wedge of soft cheese on it. He did not look as if he had a hangover. He looked astonishing. He wore tight white shorts and a sleeveless T-shirt striped in wide bands and rubber shower clogs. I stared. He looked down at himself and shrugged. Well, it was all they had downstairs that fit me. I feel like I've waked up in a strange bedroom with Casanova. I'm glad you're speaking to me, though. I hope everybody is.
Have you already been down to the pool?
Yep. It's nice. It's probably the only relatively cool spot in Italy. Ada and Sam are at the pool. I invited them last night, he said. Ada went on and on about how hot it was, and I knew we were going to have to reciprocate. We are hosting a very fancy party this morning. You know who else is down there?
John Paul II, I said acidly.
In a manner of speaking, Joe said, Yolanda Whitney, the Pope of the Hearthside, or is it Popess? In the more than considerable flesh, spilling out of the smallest bikini I ever saw. She's in Rome to shoot a show on adapting Italian crafts for the average Midwestern home or something. Apparently, the Forrests have known her forever. A 3-year-old could see she's got the hots for Sam. Apparently, it's a rather generic effect among women.
He leered showily at me, and I knew that he was not entirely happy with the time I had spent at Sam Forrest's side. Well, tough. He had allowed Ada to tow him away without so much as a backward look.
Perfect, I groaned. All this and Yolanda Whitney, too. Be still, my heart.
Yolanda was the kind of super celebrity that only American television can spawn. She had started out with a column in a supermarket women's magazine, hit the talk show circuit, and had proved astoundingly popular. Because of Yolanda Whitney, every third American home had dried flowers hanging all over the kitchen and paper bags full of sand and candles along the driveway at Christmas time. She had her own magazine, too. I had seen her a number of times on television, neatly curved and crisply aproned and bubbling with enthusiasm, her shining brown hair and a coronet of braids around her pretty head. "You go on," I said. "I'll be down in a little while."
I put on the sundress I had worn the night before, snatched a lipstick and scrawled red across my mouth, and went out slamming the door behind me. Outside, I pulled my sunglasses on and stood for a moment, letting my eyes adapt. I heard someone calling my name and turned and saw Maria standing and waving at me, and I walked toward them.
"Good morning, everybody," I said. "Is it always this hot in Rome?" A babble of voices answered me. I dropped into a chair beside Maria and hugged her. Maria in her red-flowered bikini was overpowering, brown, glistening flesh spilling everywhere, the great breasts bobbling barely contained,
all of her the firm, healthy consistency of sun-hot rubber. Her smile was wide and joyous. Colin was thickly oiled and wore black glasses like Ada's. He could not keep his eyes off Maria. Sam Forrest should have looked obscene in the small blue bikini that was almost hidden under the bulge of his belly, but somehow he did not. I thought of him as some great pagan colossus. Beside him, Joe, in his new Italian leisure clothes, looked almost pale and fussy, the classic comic Englishman on holiday in the Mediterranean. I felt shamed and mean-spirited for even thinking such a thing. Where, I wondered, was the fabled Yolanda Whitney? As if in answer, a woman heaved herself out of the pool and slumped into the chair beside Ada, shaking the bright drops of water everywhere.
"Damn, Yoli, you're worse than a wet dog,"
Sam said mildly, and Ada tossed her a towel.
"Meet our friend Yolanda Whitney," Ada said, and the woman squinted at me. "Yoli, this is Catherine Gilliard."
Yolanda Whitney's eyes were flat and dark like pebbles. She looked wrecked, downright dissipated. The sweet smell of alcohol came off her in waves, and my stomach contracted at it.
"It's a pleasure to meet you," I said. "I've enjoyed your show."
"How nice," she said. "Are you crafty, Cat?"
"I'll just bet you are."
She said it with such an unmistakably spiteful tone that I simply couldn't think of anything to reply. What was the matter with this woman? Everyone looked at her, and Ada murmured, "Charming." And Sam said from behind the sketchbook that he'd picked up,
"Put a lid on it, Yoli. It's way too early."
Her face went dull red, and she turned her back on us elaborately and walked off toward the bar. "Has my deodorant failed me?" I said.
"I apologize for her," Sam said. "She's had some very bad news from her agent. The network isn't picking up her show next year, and they're going to have to start scrambling around looking for a new one." "They will. She's too good not to." "She's had too much to drink. She's taking it out on the new gal on the block. If she does it again, I'll swat her."
Ada said, "We've known her since she was the new girl on the block herself. Nearly 20 years ago, Sam did her portrait. I'm sure she's already sorry she snapped at you, Cat. She'll tell you herself when she gets back." And she did. Yolanda Whitney came back carrying something in a frosted glass and put her hand on my shoulder and said,
"I'm sorry. I've got a foul temper. I'd been hearing all morning how you look like a Raphael, or was it a Da Vinci? And that kind of makes you mean when you look like a Bosch."
She smiled, but she was looking at Sam Forrest, and I saw that what Joe had said was true. Something hungry and hopeless looked out of her opaque eyes when they fell on Sam.
"Not like a Bosch, more like a Vermeer," he said, grinning up at her and laying the sketch pad aside.
I saw, incredulously, that he was beginning a series of pencil studies of me, and I felt my face flame even hotter.
"Sam, darling," Ada said, "why don't you put the sketch pad away? Poor Cat doesn't want to sit here all afternoon like a bug under a magnifying glass."
"That's enough for now, anyway," he said, and threw the sketchbook aside.
We sat beside the pool talking, sipping drinks, and nibbling at sandwiches. Finally, at a little after 2, we left the pool to go and dress for Colin and Maria's wedding. They were married at 6 o'clock in the evening in the Palazzo dei Conservatori on the Campo d'Olio on Capitoline Hill. Ada had outfitted Maria with a wonderful écru silk suit from Armani, and she was to wear Colin's martyred mother's pearls. Mrs. Gerard had taken to her bed from prostration and could not attend her son's pagan civil wedding, and sent in her stead the triple strand of matched pearls that had always graced the throats of Gerard brides. Joe and I saw them, Maria in her chic écru, and Colin correct in a dark summer weight suit, running hand in hand toward the Corte di Notto. Sam was behind them, still in chinos and a vast, flapping blue blazer, and Ada looking like a lit candle in peach silk. Behind everyone, cinched into a smart yellow suit, hair once again shining in its braids, Yolanda clattered along in very high heels. Sam caught sight of us and waved a massive arm. "Let the games begin," he called, and we all linked arms and ran the rest of the way up the Cordonato to the wedding of Maria and Colin. Everyone remembers something different about it.
Mostly, I remember Maria's face as she became Mrs. Colin Gerard, a bonfire of joy. Afterwards, we sat at a long table set with pink linen lit with white candles on one of the narrow streets that leads into the piazza. It was the first time, really, that Joe and I had been out in the midst of Rome, swallowed up in its jostling, hooting, honking throngs. I sat with my back to the narrow street. It was all I could do to keep from constantly swiveling my head from side to side to see what was coming. There were bottles of red and white wine already on the table, and I gulped mine down and refilled it before anyone else had tasted theirs. Desolately, I wondered if I was going to have to get drunk again in order to be able to sit at this table. On my left, Joe turned to look at me, and I read clearly in his eyes. "Don't do that again, Cat, for God's sake. Enough is enough." Over the gagging fear, hurt and embarrassment flamed. Across from me, Sam studied me for a moment and then said, "Change places with me, Cat. You can't see the Pantheon from where you are." I moved around the table on legs that threatened to collapse under me. I dropped into Sam's chair and murmured, "Thank you." He laid his hand on top of my head for a moment and then went around and sat at my abandoned chair. With the wall at my back, the Thea shrank back into its kennel and the enchantment began. We ate enormously and drank a great deal of wine. It was the first time I ever had the wonderful meaty porcini mushrooms simply brushed with oil and roasted. Colin and Maria, who were staying in a small hotel nearby, hugged everyone and drifted away, their bodies closely fitted together. Sam and Ada went into the kitchen to thank the owner, and Joe and I stood awkwardly on the pavement with Yolanda Whitney, waiting. Yolanda lurched and giggled and held on to Joe, and when Sam and Ada came back, the two men flanked her and we made our way over to the Via del Corso. Sam put Joe and me and Yolanda into a taxi. When we got to Yolanda's hotel, she was so boneless and disoriented that Joe had to walk her to her room. I waited in the back of the cab for what seemed an interminable length of time. It was almost half an hour later that Joe finally came out, and I noticed he was literally smeared with lipstick, as if he had been drinking blood. "Good Lord, Joe." "Don't ask," he said, making a face of deep disgust. "I'll tell you later, but just don't ask right now. I thought that woman was going to rape me in the hall outside her room." We met Sam the next morning in the Piazza Navona to start the Sam Forest Special and Particular Walking Tour of Rome. It was not yet 8. And the great oval square was pearled with soft light. Sam was waiting for us at Tre Scalini. He wore blue jeans, faded nearly white and cut off at the knees, and a denim work shirt open to the waist and knotted there. A battered straw hat of the sort I associated with southern plantation owners rode low on his forehead. He looked utterly ridiculous, and somehow just right.
"Okay," Sam said. "This is going to be a foot tour, and I'm going to walk your asses off. It's going to be hotter in hell by noon. Joe, the top of you's fine, but we might think about stopping and getting you some walking shoes somewhere. Cat, you're just right. The dress will keep the sun off you and reflect heat, and you've got on crepe soles. Good. Y'all about ready?"
"Well, I still don't know why you wanted me to wear this," I said to Sam, looking down in distaste. When he called early that morning, he had asked me to wear the white linen I had on last night.
"Humor me," he said, "and I'll show you before the tour is over."
He took us first into the interior of the Pantheon. Something about the sweet amplitude of space that swept up to the top of the great dome dropped a deep, abiding sense of calm, of refuge, down on me.
"The proportions are stunning, aren't they?"
Joe said.
"Pure classical geometry," Sam said. "The diameter of the dome is exactly equal to the height of the walls. Who said mathematics wasn't art?"
From there, we dog-trotted over to the austere little church that served Rome's French colony. The three great Caravaggios in the chapel of St. Matthew bloomed in their rich, deep light. We walked for what seemed a very long way, the sun beating down relentlessly. My feet were sore and burning, and behind me,
Joe was beginning to limp. I turned back to him and saw that he was pale, literally drenched in sweat. Joe played tennis 4 or 5 times a week and was perhaps 50 pounds lighter than Sam, but he was not used to the heat and the cobbles and the constant, hammering noise of Rome. We walked up to a plain brown church where, Sam said, we were going to see death Roman style. We passed down into the crypt. On one side was a simple, rough plaster wall. On the other side was bones. Human bones. Bones that formed intricate friezes and mosaics. Bones that formed entire walls and cells and small rooms. Bones that made chandeliers and decorative panels.
Look at the plaque. As we are now, so shall you be, Sam translated. I stood in that place of bones and laughed. Part of me was appalled, but a great part was oddly comforted. I turned to Joe, and I could see that he was profoundly disturbed. Back out in the sunlight again, we trudged, sweating. At my side, I could hear Joe breathing heavily, and I looked at him worriedly. We made our way along the Spanish steps, so clogged with people that we could hardly see the monumental staircase itself. Sam pointed out the house where Keats lived and died and asked if we'd like to go in. Another time, I said, frankly worried about Joe now. He was as pale as a wraith and nearly hobbling. Sam seemed to notice for the first time.
Christ, I've nearly killed you, he said. Can you make it to the top? The Hassler has a good bar. We'll get a drink, and then we can get you some decent walking shoes anywhere around here, and take a cab back to the studio.
I'm fine, Joe said thinly. I think I will get a drink, and see if there are any decent men's shops around here. I want you all to go on, though. I'll meet you back at the studio for lunch in, what, an hour and a half?
No, I'll go shopping with you, I began. Cat, I really want to be by myself for a little while, he said in a low, fast voice.
Sounds like a good plan, Sam said, taking my arm. Come on, Cat, cut a guy some slack.
See you guys later, Joe said, and he turned away from us and climbed the Spanish steps without looking back, striding purposefully. Sam gave the taxi driver an address via Vente Setembre, and I was profoundly grateful to be off my feet. Inside the church, I let Sam guide me. The light fell full on a sculpture, and I caught my breath when I looked full at it.
A not uncommon impulse, Sam said,
watching me.
The ecstasy of Saint Teresa. Bernini's ideas of sacred ecstasy and rapture got him into a little hot water.
There was so much passion in the saint's blind, naked face, so much transport and abandon, such sheer physical hunger that I felt a wave of heat spread slowly through me. The statue was powerfully beautiful and powerfully erotic. Sam stood in silence for a while and then said, "What else do you notice about it? Look at the face." I saw then. It was my face. My face over the wrinkled white linen that I wore now. My face in ecstasy. My face as only one person on earth had seen it. How had Sam Forrest known? I want to go now, I said numbly.
Don't feel strange about it, Cat, Sam said. I told you your face was all over Rome. You just have that sort of snub, narrow Renaissance look to you.
But you picked this one to show me. Why did you do that, Sam? After quite a long time, he said,
I don't know. I really don't. But I do know I meant no innuendo. I hope you'll believe that.
And somehow I did. Sam's studio was the top floor of a narrow, flaking russet house in the Via del Pellegrino, just off the Campo Fiore. The door opened, and Ada Forrest stood there,
silvery and translucent in wide black gauze palazzo pants and a loose gauze top. "Perfect timing," she said. "Did you have a good morning? You nearly killed Joe." I looked past her into the studio, searching for my husband. Down at the far end sat Joe, feet propped on a big leather hassock, drinking wine. He was saying something to Yolanda Whitney, and she was laughing. Colin and Maria lay tangled on a couch. Joe looks as though he's made a miraculous recovery. "Remarkable restorative powers, Grapes," Joe said, smiling at me. He wore a soft sage-green shirt and brilliant white running shoes. Somehow, for the first time, he seemed to fit into Rome. Yolanda got up and came to me and said in a low, chastened voice, "I want to apologize to you again. I can't drink, and I'm not going to anymore. If you'll forgive that ghastly business last night, I promise I'll leave your nice husband alone. I'd like to have you both for friends." What could one say to that? I said, "Please don't think any more about it. Friends we shall be." "Well, people," Ada said, "let's eat this fine lunch I lugged over here." Despite the heat, we ate enormously. Afterwards, Ada began gathering up the lunch things. "I think," Sam Forrest said lazily into the room at large, "that I would like to paint Cat, and I'm asking your formal permission, Joe, if she doesn't mind sitting this afternoon, of course." "Cat, you're truly blessed among women," said Yolanda. "He's only done two or three other portraits." Hers, I remembered, had been one of them. I looked up at Joe. "It's up to Cat," he said. I knew he hated the idea. "I don't think," I began, but Ada cut me off. "You really must," she said. "I'll take the rest of us somewhere fun while you sit, and we'll drop you at the station for your train to Venice by 10. I looked at Sam. "Of course I will," I said. "I'd be enormously honored." When the others had left, Sam settled me on a chair. At first I felt stiff and self-conscious, but he kept up a stream of his drawled nonsense, and soon I was laughing in at ease. Back at the Cavalieri Hilton, when I reached our room, Maria opened the door almost before I got the key in the lock. Her round face was pale and worried. "What is it?" I said, looking past her into the room. Colin lay on the sofa, his foot pillowed on the arm. His ankle was bound in an ace bandage, a pair of crutches beside him. On the bed, Joe was propped up against pillows with his shirt off. There were towels on his bare chest and a washcloth on his forehead. "My God! What's happened to Joe? What's wrong with Colin? Was there an accident?" "Not unless you call two grown-up little boys showing off and almost killing themselves an accident," Maria said. I went across the room and sat down at Joe's side and simply looked at him. "Is somebody going to tell me about it?" I said. "Everybody wanted to go to the Circus Maximus," Ada said. "It was terribly hot. When we got to the circus, there was practically nobody there, and we went out onto the field and..." She paused. Joe gave a magnificent salute to the crowd and yelled, "Morituri te salutamus." And Colin said, "I dare you," and they took off around the track in a foot race, Maria finished, in 100-plus-degree heat. It was a very good thing Colin fell and sprained his ankle, otherwise Joe would be dead of heat stroke or heart failure. We've just gotten back from the hospital.
"Oh, honey," I said to Joe and touched his cheek, "how bad is it?"
"Not so very," Ada said. "The doctor gave Joe some fluids in his arm and x-rayed Colin's ankle. Joe will be fine in a few hours. Colin has a pretty nasty sprain. No permanent damage, though."
"Well, thank God for that," I said, trying not to think of the days of driving and walking ahead. "What would we do now?"
"Oh, yes," Maria said, still angry. "He'll be well in time for the Summer Olympics."
"I've said I was sorry 1,000 times, Colin said weakly from under his washcloth. "Don't worry about it, love," I said to Maria. "We'll just stay on in Rome until he can get around better."
"Nice try, but no cigar," Joe said. "I've already called down and they can't even accommodate us past tonight. July, you know, tourist season."
"Listen," Ada Forrest said, "I've taken an awful liberty,
But see what you think about this. I called Sam a minute ago, and he thinks it's a splendid idea. We'd like to come with you. Sam can spell Joe driving, and with another man, we can manage Colin with no problem at all, and it would give him a chance to work on Kat's portrait in a much fuller way. He's really excited about that. Will you let us do it? He's packing for both of us now, and we'll meet you at the station. We were all silent for a bit. I could not take it in. Oh, Ada, you angel, Maria breathed.
It's out of the question, Joe said briskly.
His face was pink.
We couldn't possibly impose on you further.
No doubt about it, Colin said. We accept. We can't go unless it's this way.
The car won't hold us all, Joe said tightly.
Well, if it will help, Yolanda said she would come with us, Ada said. She's already called Hertz in Venice. They can get her a car, and she wants to come. CNN picked up her show, and she's celebrating. We'll go in a caravan.
That might work, Joe said.
It will work, Maria caroled. How can I ever thank you? She rushed over to Ada Forrest and hugged her hard. Ada smiled. By having a lovely life, she said, and I liked her as much in that instant as I ever have. Late that night, after a not-so-bad room-service dinner, we all met at the Stazione Termini. By the time Joe and I got our luggage wedged into the tiny cubicle and pulled down the overhead bunk, the train was swaying and clicking along. We struggled out of our clothes. Joe came into my bunk with me, and we lay close together, sandwiched in, rocking through the darkness. Joe reached over me and pulled down the shade.
We'd never forgive ourselves if we didn't, he said.
No, I said, reaching up to pull him down over me. In the dark, we might have been anywhere at all, except that the rushing, rocking of the train took us with it, deeper and harder and faster than we ever went on the mountain. A Roman fuck is not your ordinary fuck, Joe whispered later, when his breathing slowed. No, I said, quivering all over. We came into Venice at dawn. Colin in a fireman's hold made my Joe and Sam's crossed arms furious and hurting. The morning was still and thick and gray. We had been talking worriedly while we were waiting for our baggage of what to do with Colin. The Europa and Regina is making up the living room of our suite into a bedroom, Ada said. It's directly on the Grand Canal. No walking at all. And they're sending the launch for us. This way, Colin and Maria can be next door where we can look after them, and Yoli can take their room at the Fenice. This will be better all around.
Oh, God, we can't take your living room, Colin groaned. You've done too much for us, and there's no way we can afford that hotel.
Colin, Ada said patiently, but with a very slight edge in her voice, we are paying for nothing. The suite is gratis because Sam is... Sam Forrest. The manager's an old friend. He owns one of Sam's earliest Italian works. So you owe no one anything at all. And here's the hotel launch.
Then thank you, Sam and Ada, Colin mumbled, not meeting their eyes.
He did not say anything else as the boatman and Sam and Joe propped him tenderly into the hotel launch. Venice remains for me now what it was that first morning. A city shimmering in midair, somewhere between sky and water.
I truly believe Joe hated it.
I think I know why. Venice robs you of yourself and hands you back changed. It seemed that every small canal we passed was arched over with high, curved bridges. The sight of them made me uneasy. I felt goose flesh on my bare arms and rubbed them with my hands. Joe saw my gesture.
Bridges, bridges everywhere, he said lightly. Cat will go out of her skull.
Anger bit me like a stinging insect. I did not answer, but Sam did.
Well, there's a little saint, Saint Zita, I think, he said. She's the patron saint of those who must cross bridges. I'll get Cat one of her medals, and she can waltz right over every bridge in Venice.
Joe looked straight back at him.
You do that, he said.
Where in Venice did Thomas Mann die? I mean his character. I said quickly to Joe.
On the Lido, a beach, Joe said, diverted.
It's one of the places I'm going to take you, Cat. I've always wanted to see it.
I can tell you right now you're not going to like it,
Sam said equably.
It's wall-to-wall hotels and condos and fat bellies in bikinis. But don't let me discourage you.
I won't, Joe said in his school voice. Cat and I are going this afternoon.
Joe, I'm sitting, I began and bit my tongue. But I do want to see it, if you'll wait till tomorrow morning.
I'm going today, he said. You come or not, as you wish. But in the end, he did not go that afternoon. Warm spatters of rain had begun to fall, so Ada Forrest called that afternoon for Joe and Yolanda, and they went off to the academia. And I waited, stung and lonely, for Sam to fetch me to go sit for him again. Ada and Sam Forrest's suite was all that she had said it would be. The two great rooms were large, with dully shining tile and a fine old chandelier. The French doors that led out onto the terrace overlooking the Grand Canal were open, and sheer white curtains billowed back into the room. Everything danced with the reflected light from the canal. I suddenly felt shy about being in a hotel bedroom with Sam Forrest. He had his easel set up in front of one of the windows, and he moved a big, overstuffed armchair opposite it for me. He walked over to me and gave my sleeveless, scoop-necked blouse a good yank off my shoulders, laid a length of fine, silky linen across them, and draped it. His face was very close to mine, and his hands were on my bare skin, but both eyes and hands were totally absorbed in their business. I was grateful for his absorption.
"I don't like what Joe said to you this morning about the bridges," he said abruptly. "I wonder why you took it."
"I... because all it meant was that he was feeling out of sorts with himself, not knowing who he was or who I was."
"He saw a chance to humiliate his wife in front of a select group of her friends."
"No, not at all. Nobody else knows about the bridge. Joe doesn't know I didn't tell him I told you about it. He wouldn't have told anyone himself."
"I would not take any bets on that," Sam said.
"You're absolutely wrong if you think he told Ada or anybody else." I looked up at the ceiling. He was silent, working fast. "How did you meet Ada?" I said presently.
"I literally picked her up on the Spanish Steps," he said. "It was in the middle 60s, and I'd just come to Rome to paint. I'd been through every girl up and down the Spanish Steps, and then one day there she was in her little black miniskirt and white gloves, for God's sake. She'd just come from some fly-specked little village outside Naples and found a job as a secretary. First, I took her to bed, and then I painted her. And by that time, I was beginning to realize how much smoother my life ran with her around, so I married her. I haven't been sorry. She's been the best investment I ever made over the years. Ada enables."
"Do you love her?"
"I don't not love her," he said. "I need her, I guess."
"Do you love Joe?"
"Well, of course I do," I said. "I love him very much."
"But you don't need him."
"That more than anything," I said.
"No, you don't, but you don't know it yet." "I think he knows it, though, or he wouldn't need to remind you of your fears."
At 7 o'clock that evening, Yolanda Whitney and I walked from the Fenice to Harry's bar. Joe had said he would meet us there a little later. He had come in very late from his afternoon with Yolanda and Ada at the academia and wanted a nap and a bath.
"Where's Joe?" Yolanda said.
She looked crisp and young in yellow linen and citrine earrings that almost brushed her tan shoulders.
"Sleeping off the Titians and whatever Ada fed him at some marvelous little working men's bar that surpasses all the wonders of the academia," I said, and thought I probably sounded spiteful, and then knew somehow that she would understand.
"Well, she does take a bit of sleeping off, does Ada, but a perfect hostess. You must admit that."
We walked out into a swirl of pedestrian traffic. On every street corner, from every doorway, men young and old called after us, kissed their fingertips and made gestures I was just as glad I did not understand. This had not really happened before tonight. Of course, I had mostly been in groups, and moreover, in groups that included Joe and Colin and Sam. At first it was funny, and Yolanda told me to ignore it,
but one group of men persisted in following us. We were almost at Harry's when I felt a hand brush my buttocks, and then Yolanda whirled around and spat something furiously at the group.
Va fa farti, frateri! Stronzo! Mi lasci in pace! Chiamo la polizia!
When the man did not retreat, she smiled a slow, sly smile and put her arms around me and squeezed. Then she kissed me on the mouth. Loudly. The men wheeled abruptly and slunk away, muttering in disgust.
I told him to go fuck himself and to leave us alone, and then I indicated that we were lesbians. That always works when nothing else does. It's a direct disparagement to their manhood, I think. I laughed so hard I bent at the waist. She began to laugh, too. We were still standing there laughing when Sam and Ada and Maria found us.
Maria was pale, and her nose and eyes were red and swollen as if she'd been crying. When the others went into Harry's, I hung back and put my arm around her. "What is it, sweetie?"
"We had an awful fight," she said in a low voice. "I only said I'd like to go out with you all just this once to see Harry's because I've heard so much about it. He just blew up at me. He said by all means go, but it had been his impression that I'd said something recently about in sickness and in health, and he said maybe his mother had been right all along."
"Oh, Cat, that hurt."
"It's just a fight."
"You're first. Now you don't have to worry about having it later. He's angry because he can't get around and feels foolish because he knows he brought it on himself. He loves you and thinks he's spoiled things for you, and that makes him mean. He's never been mean before. He's lost control. It's different for men when that happens, I think," I said.
"You think so, really?"
"I know so, really," I said, giving her a little hug. When we went upstairs to join the others at the big table by the window overlooking the Grand Canal, she was smiling again. We met at Florian's the next morning for cappuccino and brioche, and to decide what to do with ourselves. Even before 9, the humidity was stunning, a palpable thing. When Joe and I finally awoke, neither of us mentioned the Lido, but it hung between us. There was a message for us from Yolanda when we went past the desk. "Have some crafty business over at Burano. See you for dinner. Leave a message where?"
"What's on Burano?" I said to Sam and Ada, who were waiting at a table outside Florian's.
"Yoli wants to pick up a man," Sam said. "The simple fishermen of Burano are notably potent and ardent. She's been cruising ever since we've known her, but she's smart and careful."
"Maybe we could go ourselves. Would you like to see Burano, Cat?" Ada asked.
"I thought maybe we'd take a look at St. Mark's this morning, Ada," I said. "It's the one thing I don't want to miss, and it seems awfully hot for much else."
"I," Joe said pleasantly, "am going to the Lido. Whoever wants to come with me, meet me at the landing stage in an hour."
He did not look at me.
"Then you shall surely fry," Ada said, smiling. "But I'll come with you. The hotel launch will take us for free. Cat? Sam?"
"This morning's my date with St. Lucy," Sam said. "Cat, if you want to come along, I'll trot you through St. Mark's when we're done."
"Who's St. Lucy?" I said.
"St. Lucy was a young lady of Syracuse who, when an unwelcome suitor praised her for her beautiful eyes, plucked them right out rather than tempt him further. She's become the patron saint of eyesight, and by virtue of truly Venetian logic, artists. I guess she's my only superstition. Come on, I'll show you."
I was about to say that perhaps I'd go over to the Lido with Joe and Ada after all, when Ada said, "Sam, really, don't press her. It would have to be a painful thing."
"Why?"
Sam said. "Oh, for goodness sake, because of her poor daughter," Ada said.
"Oh, God, I'm sorry, Cat," Sam said swiftly. "I just didn't think."
"Don't be silly," I said. "I'm not sensitive about Lacey's blindness. She's gotten us all way past that."
"Too bad saints can't work retroactively," Joe said. "Maybe we could lift the curse of Lacey in utero, as it were, or the German measles, or whatever."
I felt myself go cold. Nobody ever really knew what caused it, Joe. You know that. There was no evidence I had German measles. Sometimes you just don't know.
"You know, I once thought it was that fear of yours that marked her somehow," he said as pleasantly as he might be saying it was a nice day.
"K,
Cat was afraid of almost everything back then, when she was pregnant with Lacey. Of course, I know, logically, that couldn't be.
I felt run through with the pain of it and a following freezing anger.
Well, I'm not afraid anymore, I said. Not of anything. Let's get going, Sam.
I got up and walked across the sunny stones of the Piazza of St. Mark. Behind me, Joe called, Cat?
No, I said, and walked on.
Sam and I had been walking for a few minutes in silence when he said,
It's because I'm painting you, isn't it? What does he think, that I'm screwing you?
No, I said. He was punishing me today because I wouldn't go to the Lido with him. It isn't that I obey him. It's that we've always wanted the same things. But now, over here, it's like we're two twins who've always been told we were just alike, and then we woke up one day and found that we were very separate people. We are surprised and hurt and angry. Let's drop it.
Consider it dropped, Sam said.
On my right, in a tiny shop crammed into an arcade, I saw an array of religious medals. You promised me a bridge-crossing medal, I said.
So I did, he said,
and chose a small oblong medal on a pewter-colored chain.
Saint Zita.
Sam lifted off my hat and dropped the chain over my head. The medal fell into the small hollow between my damp breasts. It felt wonderful. After the typical dog-trot Sam Forest tour of San Marco and the Palazzo Ducale, we trotted toward the Europa and went out onto one of the terraces. Joe and Ada sat under an umbrella at the far corner of the terrace, their heads together, talking without smiles. I thought, it was a bad morning. He's disappointed with the Lido and angry for insisting. When we got closer, I saw that his face and arms were scarlet with sunburn, and that even Ada's seemingly impervious white satin skin was washed with plum-colored sunburn. It was a sort of sunburn that spoke of serious pain later. Sam was staring without expression at his wife. I looked. On the back of her upper arm, just above the line of the white blouse, were the distinct white prints of fingers, just fading from her burnt skin. Fingers that had pressed and held. I knew that they could not have been her own. We ate cold soup in silence. I knew that the unexplained fingerprints would slide into the stew of festering strangeness.
You were right to pass on the Lido, Joe said. It was god-awful. Wall-to-wall people, and the water at the public beaches is a sewer.
But you got a lot of sun, I said. Lord, Ada, I hope you've got something to put on your back and shoulders. I'm sending Joe home with the jar of wonderful stuff I get in Rome that will take the fire right out of him, Ada said. That and a nap will do it. I plan to spend all afternoon at a discreet little salon that will work all kinds of magic on me. There won't be a trace of red tonight. Sam and I are going to take you and Joe and Yoli, if anybody can find her, to Dospare, that little place where Joe and I had lunch yesterday. We'll have to eat early. It closes at 8. Soon after that, we left the terrace, Sam and I to go upstairs for another painting session. I was nearly limp with exhaustion. Nothing had happened, really, and yet, in some subterranean manner, a great deal had. I went to the chair and sat down. Sam moved to his position behind the easel and stood for a moment staring at it. Is something wrong? I asked.
No. I mean, yes. Cat, please don't think there's anything going on between Ada and Joe. There isn't. I can promise you that I would know if there was. And he's crazy about you. A fool could see that. He wouldn't be so angry at you if he wasn't. But he needs to clean up his act with you. He shouldn't take you for granted.
It seems to me you take Ada for granted.
On the contrary. I may not show it, but I am aware at all times of what Ada wants and needs. Have you and Joe really never had anybody else?
No. We really never have. He laughed softly.
I was just thinking. There's a quality about you, something in your face, essentially still untouched, he said, beginning to paint.
I sat silent for a time then. I felt myself drifting away.
I'm not sure when the sounds began. I lifted my head, my neck stiff, listening. Sam had stopped painting and stood still. "What on earth?" I said, turning toward the escalating sounds, and then I knew. The quickening creak of springs, a high, thin keening, a lower moaning that grew sharp, and a kind of dark crooning, a long, hoarse cry, and then silence. I had heard it all before, in the back of an old car. I put my hand over my ears and shut my eyes and rocked myself back and forth in the chair. After a moment, Sam came over and gently pulled my hands away. "Why does that frighten you so?" "That's how it sounded. My parents. That's how it sounded the night they..."
"But doing it doesn't frighten you, Cat. I mean, you and Joe. You do that, don't you?"
"Yes," I said. "We do that all the time. But I don't make that sound. I don't make any sound. I never have. I try, but no sound comes out."
"Because if you make a sound, you won't hear the danger coming. That's it, isn't it?"
"Yes." He put his arms around me and pulled me to my feet. He bent his head down to mine, and I lifted my mouth to his. And he kissed me, long and sweetly and softly, and then not softly anymore. His hands moved down my back and around and up to my breasts, and then all over me, and I gave him back touch for touch.
"Cat," Sam said hoarsely, "I promise you that before you leave Italy, you will make a very joyful noise, and it will be with me, but not now."
"This shouldn't have happened," I whispered.
"I promise you, Cat, that I won't touch you until you ask me," Sam said. "And, Cat, you will ask."
When I got back to the Fenice, there was a note from Joe saying he and Ada and Yolanda had gone on to Dos Fare, and for me to ask Sam to bring me. "Don't come alone," Joe said. "You can't handle it alone."
"In a pig's ass I will," I said to myself. I stripped off my clothes and took a very long, hot shower. And then I dressed and went downstairs and asked the desk clerk to draw me a map to Dos Fare.
I strode swiftly and purposefully through the campo and into the maze of small calle that would take me to Teatro Rossini, the first of the landmarks the map told me to look for. Some of the alleys led nowhere, and some seemed to lead back to where I thought I had just walked. The hair on the back of my neck prickled. Several groups of men called after me, and one or two made as if to follow me, but I glared at them as Yolanda had taught me, and they faded away. I stopped and studied the map. There was something in the shadows, shapes shifting, moving. Cats. I looked harder. Many cats, slipping through the shadows, watching me. Not precisely feral, but not house pets either. Here, just around this corner and over a bridge, should be the Campo Manin. And here it was. I took a deep breath and felt my heart slow. I could do this. I sailed out of the Campo Manin and back into the heart of this other Venice, and into the dark. It was a darkness that was more than the sudden dying of the light. Where was the post office, the Rialto Bridge, the lights, the people of Venice? I was lost. All right, stop and take a deep breath. Don't be afraid. I am afraid. Presently, I looked again at the map. I heard footsteps, several of them, brisk and firm and confident. I would find the walkers, and I would walk just behind them. I hurried down the alley and ran straight into them. Four men who did not look like husbands and fathers going home for dinner. They stopped, barring my way. "Scusi," I said, and my voice trembled. "Where is the post office?"
They smiled. They looked at each other, and then they began to make that simple-minded crooning that I had thought was so funny when I first heard it with Yolanda. And they began to walk toward me very slowly. I turned and walked very fast back down the way I had come.
Behind me, I could hear them coming fast, almost running. I began to run. I ran over a bridge and down the other side. I reached the opening. Dead end. No way out. I turned to the men behind me. "Vaffa farti, frateri stronzi!" I screamed. "Vaffanculo!" I went at them with my fingers curved into claws, my eyes screwed shut, and my mouth wide open. I must have seemed a madwoman. The men stopped, backed up, muttered among themselves, turned around, and sauntered out of the campo, laughing. They did not look back. I went over and sat down on the steps of the little church there. I sat there for what seemed like a long time. I had no idea what time it was. There was another sound, a thin, wavering, strangling sound. I looked toward it by the door of one of the dark houses. It was a cat crouched low, its head hanging, wheezing for breath. The cat was very sick. I knew that it was dying. I thought simply that this was more than anyone should have to bear, and got up to go away from there, to begin my hopeless journey through the streets again, and saw the others. All around the dying cat, other cats were ranged utterly silent and still in a circle. They waited. I ran. I ran a long time, and when I had to stop, my sides knife-stitched, I was at a street corner where a few people were gathered. I began to cry, and ran around the corner, and was in the elegantly lit Campo La Fenice. There were the crowds of well-dressed, strolling people, and in the midst of them, Sam Forrest, at a table on the fringe of the space, staring straight across at me. Beside him sat Yolanda. They got up hastily and came to me. It was Sam who caught me and held me, smoothing back my hair, rocking me gently back and forth. He listened as I said, "I thought I could find you all, but I got lost. I saw a cat die, Sam, and I think some others ate it." His face twisted and he said fiercely, "God damn them for going off and leaving you, and you for not calling me. We have been looking for you for 2 hours."
"Joe," I said. "Is Joe here?"
It was Yolanda who spoke then. "They're waiting at Dos Padres for you. Sam and I went out looking. Right now I am taking you up and putting you straight to bed." She led me into the Fenice and up to our room. "Sleep late," she said. "And then about 10, you and I are going to have a long breakfast and go shopping and bleed Joe Gilliard's American Express card bone dry." I did not stir until after 9 the next morning, and by then Joe was gone again. There was a note. "Have gone over to the hotel with Ada to help get Colin up and dressed. He insists on coming to lunch. See you there. By the way, where were you last night? We waited and waited." I felt tears sting. No, I was not going to cry any more. I showered and dressed and went downstairs. The desk clerk told me that Signora Whitney was waiting for me in the garden. Yoli was there at the table, drinking cafe lunga. Her hair in a ponytail, she looked about 15. It struck me that she had looked younger and healthier each day we had been with her. She looked up and smiled, and I smiled back. "Ready to do some serious Joe Gilliard bashing?" she said.
"You mean shopping?"
"Shopping, dishing, bitching, whatever," she said, pouring coffee for me. "He was an asshole last night. I told him so this morning."
"Lord, Yoli, what did you say?"
"That you'd gotten yourself lost where nobody in their right mind goes after dark, and practically walked yourself to death trying to find the restaurant, and a bunch of greasers cornered you and nearly raped you, and you ran into all kinds of gruesome things, and what in the hell did he think he was doing sitting there while Sam and I were out of our minds trying to find you?"
"Oh, God," I breathed. "I was going to handle it."
"Listen," she said, "I know that you've had agoraphobia. And I know that you've been in therapy and gotten strong enough to come all the way over here. Christ, Cat, you turned around and stood up to those creeps and ran them right out of the campo.
As Winston Churchill said, some chicken.
We stared at each other, and then we began to laugh. The awfulness of the night before took a sliding skew in my mind and became darkly funny, a story I could tell and retell for many years. I wanted to reach across the table and hug her.
What did Joe say when you told him?
He said he was sorry. He had no idea, Yolanda said. And to give him his due, I think he really was. Come on, you ready to shop till we drop? As we walked across the great piazza heading for the shops, I thought of something.
When did Joe tell you I had agoraphobia?
He didn't, she said. Ada did, way back in Rome. I said nothing, only walked beside her. She knew then. And if she knew, who told her, Sam or Joe? I did not know which prospect bothered me the most, and so I let it go. We did indeed shop till we dropped, and by noon our arms were laden with packages. I bought a beautiful lace tablecloth for Marie and Colin, a dress of silvery green for myself. For Joe, shirts of Sea Island cotton, ascots, a gorgeous off-white silk slub jacket, a black silk T-shirt, and a Panama hat with a black ribbon band. When I got back to our room, staggering under my load of plunder, Joe was there, stretched out on the bed. He looked at me, not quite smiling. "Hey," he said. "I was afraid I'd miss you again. Come here and give me a kiss, and then I'll start telling you how shitty I feel about last night." I dumped the packages and dove onto the bed on top of him.
"I'm so glad to see you," I said.
We lay there lazily until well after one, the thumping overhead fan cooling our naked bodies, our legs loosely entwined. "I bought you some surprises," I said. He got up and opened the boxes, smiling quizzically. He walked, still naked, to the pier glass in the corner to look at himself in the fedora. He turned to me, grinning. I could tell that he liked himself in the hat. Then he came over and sat down on the edge of the bed facing me. "Yoli gave me holy hell this morning," he said, "and she should have. I had no idea you'd been through such a bad time last night. I'm sorry. I've left you by yourself way too much on this trip. I'm not going to do it again. You've done wonderfully well over here. I haven't even told you that, have I? That I'm proud of you? I'm going to take better care of you. If you'll forgive me?" They were the words I'd wanted to hear, and they should have made me feel cherished and safe. Instead, I bristled inside, very slightly. He began to collect his luncheon outfit from among the things I'd bought him. I sat for a little space of time, feeling inexplicably out of sorts, and then I got up and showered and dressed. He wore the hat, the black silk T-shirt, the creamy jacket, and a red ascot. He looked, literally, like no one I'd ever seen before, theatrical and foreign and incredibly handsome. By the time we reached the greedy terrace, the others had gathered under one of the ubiquitous market umbrellas. Sam and Ada sat together with their backs to the canal. Colin Gerard half sat, half lay. He was noticeably thinner, and his golden tan had gone mustard yellow, but he was smiling widely. Maria was a pasty shadow of the buxom, joyous young woman whose marriage we had celebrated not a week earlier. Yolanda was not present. After we had finished lunch, the waiter brought espresso and coffee, and we lingered on. Someone produced a small camera. Joe grinned and got up and took the camera and squinted into it. "Turn around and face the water," he said, his eye pressed to the viewer. "Come in closer together. I can't get you all in." He stepped backwards. Once. And then twice. "Joe!" I shouted. He waved at me to be quiet, stepped back again, and went straight down into the water of the Grand Canal. For an instant, only his hat bobbed on the oily water. I gasped, unable to say a word. No one else did either. Only when Joe's head shot up out of the water, his eyes closed, spitting and flailing, did anyone move or speak. "Oh, God! Darling," I cried and started for him. Sam Forrest began to laugh. It did not help at all that it was Sam's great arms that fished Joe out of the water as if he had been a small child. Not at all.
That afternoon, he took a long, hot shower in our room. He scrubbed himself until he was raw and red, and I thought once that I heard him vomiting. I knew he hated the thought of it. Filthy, he had called it. Full of excrement and dead things. My heart hurt with pity for him. He caught a cold. I heard the coughing start in the night before we left, a dry, tight sound that I recognized. Joe seldom gets sick, but when he does, it is a baroque sickness, florid and full-blown. He was very sick all the way to Florence. The doctor Ada had called, a slender, pale Florentine, was waiting for us in the cool, tapestry-hung lobby of the Villa Carroll when we got there. The Villa Carroll remains one of the loveliest places I have ever seen. It sits in a cool green park planted with formal green-black cypresses, full of secret grottos and small gardens and fountains. The whole affair overlooks Florence from its hill. The doctor pronounced his judgment on the bad waters of Venice and gave him several injections. He also left a vial of pills. Colin was not so lucky. The impassive doctor poked and prodded, clicked his tongue, shook his head, and pronounced the ankle fractured instead of sprained. "It should have been seen to immediately and set in a cast," he said disapprovingly. "No wonder he has the pain." He left with Colin and Maria in the back seat of his large black Lancia. And so Colin was ministered to and came back in an hour properly cast and medicated, saying that the pain was better already. Joe had been dosed and put to bed. I sat with Sam and Ada in the garden near the pool. Yolanda was staying at a small pension where she always stays in Florence. Now what we must all do is simply to be still and rest, Ada said. It was what we did for the entire remainder of our stay there. We rested. Only Sam was painting furiously now, largely silently. He was withdrawn, but there was a new electricity about him. Joe was still asleep when I started down to breakfast the next morning, but when I touched his face, it was cool and dry. Just as I was pulling the door shut, he called sleepily, "Cat, where are you going?" I went back into the room. "Down to breakfast. I thought you were asleep. How do you feel?"
"I think I feel better," he said. He stretched long and hard.
"Maybe if you feel like it, you can come down to dinner. You don't want to push it too hard with the drive to Siena coming up tomorrow." "I'm sorry about this," he said, looking up at me. "I don't even remember getting here. I'm going to miss Florence completely. Have you even seen a scrap of it?" "I think I might go down this morning," I said. "Maria said she wanted to do a fast lap around the Uffizi. To tell you the truth, it's been good just to stop for a day or two."
"I've missed you," he said, and drew my hands to his mouth and kissed the palm. "I've missed you, too," I said.
The Villa Carroll's van dropped us off at the Ponte Vecchio, and we walked slowly along the old bridge, past the small jewelry shops, past the vendors and portrait artists and sidewalk performers. I felt a prickle of the old bridge fear, but after a few minutes, I began to revel in it. I bought things, a pair of austere silver candlesticks for Corrine, a heavy gold cup with bas-relief lions and unicorns on it for Lacey. She would love the satin feel of it, and the fine detail of the animals. And it would look beautiful on her slender arm. I missed her in that instant, as you miss a newly amputated limb. We walked to the Uffizi Gallery, into a world made of flesh and shadow and light. We were totally silent as we walked through the great crowded salons. Few other people spoke either. It was the most unrelievedly sensuous 2 hours I have ever spent. It was the sheer living presence of so much naked flesh that took my breath.
"Wow," Maria said.
"I wonder how many babies have been conceived after a trip to the Uffizi." When I got back to our room, I softened my steps and
eased the door open, in case Joe was sleeping. But he was not. He stood at the French doors on the balcony, his back to the room, in only his pajama bottoms. Ada Forrest stood in the circle of his left arm. They did not move. Then Joe bent his head down to her, and she lifted hers, and he kissed her. I moved then. I ran on tiptoe up the staircase at the end of the hallway to Sam and Ada's room and knocked on the door. Sam answered the door in a ratty blue terry cloth robe. "What's the matter?" "Nothing. I just forgot my key, and I thought you might come down to lunch with me." He pulled me into the room.
"Let's order some lunch up here, and you can sit for a while, if you will."
He phoned down for lunch, staring at me as he talked. I concentrated fiercely on talking normally and eating and drinking. I thought I did well, but it was better when he worked in silence. I think I must have dozed, because when Sam said,
"Well, look who's in the land of the living,"
I started violently. He stood on the balcony looking down at the pool, and I went to look, too. Maria and Colin and Joe sat in chairs, sipping drinks and laughing at Ada, who was doing a sinuous, absurd little dance around the pool. She had a scarlet hibiscus thrust between her teeth. Joe called something to her through cupped hands, and she rushed at him and planted a long kiss square on his mouth and went back to her dancing.
"Is that what's bothering you?"
I shook my head, but he said,
"I believe it is. It means less than zero. Ada does that. Some women shop and some do volunteer work. Ada kisses men."
My husband doesn't kiss women, I thought. Or didn't. Aloud, I said lightly, "I don't mind. Why should I?"
"Joe's wife kisses Ada's husband. Or had you forgotten?" "Not hardly," Sam said,
looking at me without smiling. He stepped back into the room and opened his arms to me, and I went into them and raised my face and closed my eyes. He kissed me, and his mouth moved to my throat and then to my breast. And he pulled me hard into the curve of his body, and I could feel the heat of him. Something deep inside me that had been clenched and chilled ever since we got to Italy softened and opened. The phone rang. I froze. He did not move either. "Let it ring," he murmured hoarsely. But the moment was gone, broken. Finally, he moved away from me and went to the desk and picked up the phone. Presently, I felt rather than saw him come back.
"Yoli wanting to know what time to come to dinner."
His voice was thick and hoarse.
"Well, Cat, saved by the bell. Unless you were asking."
I turned to him and put my hands on his shoulders and smiled. Somehow, things were better now. The savage pain was gone.
"Not yet," I said.
"Not quite yet."
"Ask soon, Cat."
"I will," I said. "I will."
Our last dinner in Florence did not quite gel. The food was wonderful, and we drank a great deal of wine, but there was a lingering feeling of unease and disorder. Maria's eyes glittered. Beside her, Colin tossed back brandy and did not look at her. "They've had a fight," I thought. Yolanda was drinking quite a bit for the first time since Rome. She was not at all drunk, though, simply quieter. Her mouth seemed swollen, and there was an unmistakable fading hickey on her neck. At the end of the meal, Joe said, "I did a smart thing. I went off and left all my traveler's checks in the safe in Venice."
For some reason, it infuriated me.
"Damn it, Joe, when did you discover that wondrous feat?"
He looked at me in confusion.
I was not generally sarcastic with Joe. "There's bound to be an office in Siena," he said. "I have an even better idea," Yoli said. "Cat, why don't you stay over another day and get them here in the morning, and I'll show you my Florence. You can have half my bed. It's absolutely huge. We'll drive over to Siena the next morning. It's only 40 miles.
"Well, you know, maybe. I might," I said.
"What's one day?" Yolanda said briskly. "Cat hasn't had much for herself this trip." "Do what you like, of course,"
Joe said distantly. There was a silence around the table.
"Let's do it," I said.
They left early the next morning for Siena, Ada at the wheel, Maria beside her, Sam alone on the middle seat, already opening his sketchbook, Joe and Colin in the back seat. Joe looked at me through the open window. He was still annoyed at me. I watched the station wagon move out of sight down the curving drive. I was so happy as to be almost giddy. I ordered a pot of coffee and two cups when Yolanda came out. She had her hair in one fat, glossy braid down her back and wore a peasant blouse pulled down on her brown shoulders and an ankle-brushing skirt slit far up her sleek thigh. "Buongiorno," she said, slipping into the opposite chair. "You look like Madeline this morning." I looked down at my navy shirt dress with its white sailor collar. It did indeed look like the uniform of a French convent school.
"It's a good combination, the sacred and the profane. You can get us into churches, and I can get guys for us. It works out perfectly."
I laughed aloud. When Yoli dropped me off at the American Express, the line was out the door. By 12, there were still 4 people ahead of me. Each of them held enough documenti to precipitate individual international monetary crises. Yoli wandered in every now and then, looked over the situation, and drifted back out to browse along the Ponte Vecchio. "I'm so sorry," I said. "I should have let Joe get this in Siena." My turn came at last, and we made our way through the crowd to the door. "Pick somewhere wonderful for lunch," I said. "It's my treat. It's the least I can do after botching up your whole morning."
"I don't mind," she said equably. "Let's walk. I love Florence. It's good grazing, if you know what I mean. You can meet interesting men without having to fight them off until you find one you don't want to fight off."
I looked at her. It crossed my mind that she might really be pathological in some way, be a nymphomaniac, if anyone still used that sad, innuendo-sodden word. But then I thought she was too successful to be driven by pathology. Yoli steered me toward a trattoria where a few umbrellas had been set out. "Mano has the best tribolita in town," she said, sinking into one of the chairs. When the bean soup came, we fell upon it like starving foundlings. It was quite late now. The heat was draining slowly out of the day. We left the Piazza San Spirito and walked slowly back to her little hotel. The Centrale, it was called. Yoli's room was large and high-ceilinged and starkly furnished with a huge bed. I ran a bath in the claw-footed old tub and climbed in. Presently, she brought me a glass of good red wine, and I lay sipping it and thinking nothing at all except that I was happy. We sat out on the roof terrace for a bit. "Could we just go get some spaghetti or something?" I said. We went down the woozy elevator and turned left, walking into an alley. I stumbled behind Yolanda in the gloom, tripping on the slick, uneven cobbles. Presently, she stopped. I stood behind her in utter darkness, and I heard her bang on a brass knocker. The door opened, and light spilled out into the stairwell, and we went inside. It was a cellar of some sort. Groups of people loomed out of the murk like ships out of a heavy fog. The man she called Tato had kept a table for us in the very back, and we slid into chairs. It was quieter here, and there was a good view, if you could call it that, of the bar, which was 3 deep with young men. "Where are all the women?" I said. "Oh, they come and go. Mostly they're upstairs right now." It dawned on me. "My God, Yoli, this is a bordello."
"Don't worry," she said. "Your virtue is safe with me. I established a long time ago that I don't work here. I just shop." A waiter appeared with 3 bottles of wine. Yoli tasted the wine, nodded, and ordered the pasta of the house. "Well," she said, lifting her glass and clicking it to mine, "to your night in a Florentine whorehouse. You can dine out on it for years."
I drained my glass, and she refilled it. It would make a wonderful story, I thought.
"How's the portrait coming?"
"Nearly done," I said.
"Ah. And you haven't seen it yet?"
"Nobody has."
"Ada has. You can bet your bottom."
I looked at her more closely. Were the bright eyes a bit too bright? Her words just the slightest bit slurred? "You don't like Ada," I said.
"No, you don't either. Why don't you? Is she fucking Joe?
God, no, I cried. At the bar, heads turned to look at us. She was silent, smiling slightly.
Ah, she said softly.
No, I said again, she's not fucking him. I don't think, but she's kissing him, or vice versa, or both. I saw them yesterday at lunch.
Well, then, are you fucking Sam?
Through the Chianti, I felt a clear, sharp rush of anger. Certainly not. Why would you think I'd do that?
He does that when he's doing portraits,
Yoli said, matter-of-factly, reaching for the bottle.
It's just that you've spent all that time together, and you do seem terribly vulnerable. Not even a few kisses, Cat?
I don't like the way this is going, Yoli, I said with as much dignity as I could muster around my thick tongue.
Ah, she said. So there has been a little slap and tickle.
I felt tears start in my eyes. She put her hand over mine.
Americans behave badly in Italy, Cat. All of us, in one way or another. You ought to stop it now, though. He'll hurt you.
Maybe I'll hurt him, I said pettishly.
Oh, Cat, you can't. There's nothing there to hurt. The other side of him is just this flat, pure plane of focus and energy. It all goes to the work. You can't chip it with dynamite.
I was angry, really angry. You make him sound inhuman. He's not. She stared at me.
You planning on fucking him? If you are, you better hurry. You've only got between now and the instant he finishes that painting. After that, you're history.
I started to get out of my chair. She grasped my wrist. Her grip was strong.
Stay, she said. I need to tell you something about Ada and Sam. It's for your own good, Cat. It really is. But I have to go pee first. I really do. Don't go, okay, Cat?
I won't, I said. I wondered if I could get her to eat and sober up. I looked up and I saw her standing in the doorway to the toilet. She was looking at a young man who stood at the bar. He was tall and slender and his glossy hair grew down his forehead into a point. He was in profile to me and he was looking straight at Yolanda.
He was smiling slightly and his hand rested casually on an enormous erection that strained his pants. She smiled in return. I knew that we would not be leaving. She wobbled unsteadily back to our table. She was serious now. Well, first, Ada wasn't a secretary when he met her on the Spanish steps, Yoli said. She was a prostitute. Young, alone, and far from home, scared to death and turning tricks because she couldn't afford an apartment. He was young and stupid and wanted to paint her, and he did. And while he was doing it, he fell in love with her. For his pains, she gave him the clap. Gonorrhea. God knows how long she'd had it. By the time he showed symptoms and got to a doctor, the damage was done. He's been sterile ever since. Later, he became impotent for long periods of time. He always blamed her for that, though the doctors told him it didn't have anything to do with the disease. She's sterile, too, of course. She had a hysterectomy not too long after that. I think they stayed together because she willed it. She literally made herself over into the Ada you see now. Glamorous, serene, confident. Capable of running his life and work like nobody else could. He is the painter he is today because of her. When the impotence started, he also started to get long, dry spells when he couldn't paint. She cured the first one by getting a woman called Verna Cardigan to sit for him. He fell in love with Verna and had the first really great show of his life. When I met him at the embassy party and he brought me home, he was in the middle of another drought. I cured him of it, courtesy of Ada. The fertile spell I started outlasted me for years, but he's been dry for a long time until this summer. Until you came along. I don't have to tell you how simple Ada has made it for Sam to paint you. She's literally taken charge of Joe so you could be alone with Sam. They were getting low on money, and Sam wasn't getting many calls from the art magazines anymore. This new show will probably set them up for life.
I stared at her.
I'm not saying he doesn't really feel something for you, Yoli said. But you need to know that when he's finished your portrait, he's shot his wad.
How do you know all this? Did he tell you? I could barely whisper.
No, she did. Much later, as cool as a cucumber.
Why?
Who knows, Yoli said. I don't know. If she thought telling me would cure me of Sam, she was right. Rage shook me. No, she wasn't. You're not anywhere near over him. If you were, you'd never bother to tell me all this. You're jealous. You want me to stop?
I stopped, hearing my own words. He was not like that. None of this was true. She made it up. But there was no malice in her eyes, no anger. She looked at me and then shrugged. She turned her head toward the bar. Slowly, she pulled the elasticized neck of the peasant blouse down off her shoulders and bared one large brown breast and touched it with the tip of her fingers. Behind me, the bar exploded. I scrambled to my feet. I am not going to stay and watch this, I said furiously. She was still looking at the young man at the bar. Then she fished the room key out of the purse. She handed it to me.
I think I'll stay a while, she said.
I took the key and walked out of the restaurant. As I passed the young man, I saw that he had started across the room toward her, bearing the erection before him like a battle standard. When I reached the room, I rummaged a half-forgotten vial of sleeping pills Corrine had sent with me, swallowed two with tap water, and crawled naked into the huge white bed. I was asleep practically before my head touched the pillow. I woke the next morning and sat up groggily. She was not there. I found a note, though, stuck on the bathroom mirror with a Band-Aid.
Have decided to stay over a while. Key to the car is on chest under your purse. Map on the back of the note. Take the car and drive to Siena and tell everybody I'll catch up to them or maybe call. Love, Y.
I sat down heavily on the bathroom floor. I can't drive to Siena by myself, I whispered aloud. I looked back down at the note. There was a postscript.
Yes, you can, it read.
I put my hands over my face. The fear rolled up like a volcano erupting, pure and terrible, stronger than it had ever been on the mountain or anywhere else. I began to cry and to rock myself. Then suddenly the fear drained away, and icy, crystalline anger flowed in behind it like an avalanche.
I got up and dressed, then I got the opal and drove to Siena.
Yolanda sent me the old way. It took much longer because of the narrow, twisting roads. At first, shimmering with anger, I raged inwardly at her, adding this impossible route to the litany of her sins. But soon I saw that she had literally given me the gift of Tuscany. I would have missed it on the autostrada. I came to Siena via the Chianti Gianna, the 18th-century wine route from Florence. I saw them clearly for the first time then, the Citti di Colli, the little cities on the hill. Each was separate unto itself and its hill. Each was the same as the other, and yet profoundly not the same. But nothing had prepared me for the sunflowers. They were incredible, fantastic, flaming Van Gogh suns, acres of them sweeping away from the road. I stopped the car and laid my head on the steering wheel and wept. I wept because I was no longer afraid and knew that I would not be again. I wiped my eyes on the heel of my palm and put the opal in gear and drove on. I swerved the car in between the stone gateposts of the Villa di Falcone and skidded to a stop. It was a sprawling, honey-colored building, more rustic by far than the Villa Carroll. Before it lay a semicircle of raked gravel, and to each side I could see hedges and fruit trees and gardens. I smiled enormously and went up the path to the lobby and up to the small windowed cubicle. A man with a jet-black crew cut and bluish jowls sat behind the window.
Mi chiamo Caterina Gilliard, I said. I have just come from Florence. It sounded wonderful, tossed in ever so casually.
Oh, yes, Mrs. Gilliard, the man said in perfect English. Your husband and his party are waiting for you on the pool terrace. It's down the path.
I looked at both dirt paths, but neither of them gave me a clue as to what lay at their ends. I shrugged and took one. The old flagstones led through the underbrush and then down a flight of narrow stone steps. The trees and undergrowth leaned closer, and I put my head around a great clump of rhododendron and saw a small clearing. In the center of the glade stood a ramshackle shed, and beyond it a great ravine yawned. It was spanned by a swinging rope bridge that looked centuries old. I turned to go back when I saw the falcon. It sat on a perch in a tall cylindrical cage made of rusted iron. It was the size of a large crow, feathered in a sleek slate gray. It looked impassively at me with cold yellow eyes. It could not have spread its wings if it had wanted to. The cage was too narrow. For some reason, my chest burned with sorrow and my throat ached. I turned away. When I reached the garden, I was almost running. As I neared the bottom of the other path, I heard Joe laughing. I walked around the last curve in the path, and there they were. Sam looked up as if I'd called his name and saw me. Joe and Ada turned, too, and got to their feet. Joe kissed me and said, "We'd given you all up. Where's Yoli?" "She decided to stay on in Florence," I said, grinning at them. I watched it sink in around the table. "I brought the car on over myself. I don't think she's coming."
"You did?"
Joe could not seem to take in what I had said. "I really did," I replied, watching the import of my trip fill his eyes and face. He smiled at me slowly. It was a delighted smile, but a little wary, too, almost shy. "Cat, dear, I think this calls for champagne," Ada said. "Now tell us all about it." Suddenly I was tired. I found that I did not want to talk about the drive, and certainly not the night before. I knew that I would not tell them. Maybe Joe, a little later. "Ada, you wouldn't believe how uninteresting it all was," I said.
"Tonight will be your victory dinner," Sam said. "Maybe another kind of celebration, too."
We drank a lot of champagne that afternoon and had more wine with our lunch. We laughed some more and talked and lingered by the pool. Finally, Ada stretched. "I believe I'll go up," she said. "I'm really pretty tired." I looked at her. I had never heard Ada admit tiredness, but her voice was fragile, and she did look slackened, emptied out. "Please go on," I said. "We've all but worn you to a shred this trip." Sam glanced up at her. There was a look between them, long and unreadable.
"Do," he said. "You've earned it. Let's meet at the bar at 6:30.
We all got up to our rooms. Joe's and mine was on the top floor looking straight out across the valley to Siena. "Are you sure you're okay?" Joe asked. "It was good for me," I said.
"Christ, Cat, you've only been by yourself once since we got married, in Venice. And look what happened to you. It almost destroyed you."
"It wasn't Venice or being alone that nearly destroyed me," I said carefully. "It was the fear of those things that did the damage. There was nothing dangerous but my own fear. There never has been. And Joe, that's gone. It's gone." He looked at me for a long time. His eyes spoke.
"How can we live without your fear?" they said.
"However we must," I said back with mine, "because I will not live with it again." Presently he squeezed my hand and turned over and went to sleep. In a little while I, too, fell into a light sleep. When I awoke, I dressed quietly, pulling on the newly laundered white linen that Sam had favored when I sat for him. I looked in the lounge. While we slept, it had been colonized by a group of American men, 7 or 8 of them, and they were standing around the piano singing loudly. Their southern accents were thick and slow, slightly slurred now by what I assumed to be quite a lot of bourbon.
They were just bawling out the last lines of Go Alabama Crimson Tide, and then they bayed, Deek, deek, deek! Sam Forrest stood behind me, very close, looking mildly at them. Why don't you buy me a drink on the terrace? I said. Joe will be down in a little. I feel like bourbon, I think.
I'll ask the manager to see if he can scare us up a waiter, Sam said.
Okay. Oh, wait. I was to ask him something myself, I said, and went with him to the little window. The man nodded at us. I wanted to ask you about the falcon, I said. Is he yours?
He is a she, the man said, smiling. She is a peregrine, a hunting falcon. I trained her myself. When do you hunt her? Sam asked. Oh, I do not hunt her when there are people about, the manager said. She is unstable, and she frightens people. She has a very, what do you say, eerie call.
Wee-choo! Wee-choo!
I hunt her very early in the mornings.
Does she ever try to get away? I said.
Oh, no. She does not know about flying free. She has never flown unless it was to return to the arm. For her, it is a part of flight, like the patterns.
Patterns?
They make patterns out over the hills. They divide up their range in patterns and fly them, looking down. I think it makes things clearer for them. By God, I'd like to see that, Sam said.
I wish I could invite you, but I dare not, the manager said.
I quite understand, Sam said.
We walked away onto the terrace. Joe and Colin and Maria were there. Colin and Maria sat side by side, bright social smiles painted on their faces. So they had not patched up their quarrel then.
The waiter brought a bottle of bourbon and ice, and Sam poured us drinks. We clinked glasses, and Sam said, To beginnings and endings. The beginning of a whole new cat. After driving here by yourself, I mean. And the ending is the ending of the painting. I decided this afternoon it was finished. I thought I might unveil it before we went to dinner.
He rose and went inside to get the painting. We all sat still looking at one another.
Sam came back with an oblong wrapped in newspaper and tied with string. Ada was not with him. Where's Ada? Joe asked. Ada has taken one of her sleeping pills and gone to bed, Sam said. She asked me to give you all her regrets. She does this occasionally, after she's been going on all burners for a while.
He fumbled with the string around the painting.
Behold, cat, he said.
There was a silence, and then gasps. It was me, no doubt about that. My own face thrown back. Eyes shut, mouth open, neck corded with some force that suffused it with pink. I recognized its genesis, Bernini Saint Teresa. It also looked like me at the precise moment of climax, as no one in the world had ever before seen me, except Joe Gilliard.
Colin cleared his throat. It's a very fine piece of work, Sam. Very powerful.
I looked over at Joe. His face was still and very pale. It's modeled on a Bernini statue that we saw in Rome that afternoon you didn't come with us, I said chattily to Joe. It's a remarkable likeness. It's called Saint Teresa in Ecstasy.
Maybe we can call this one Cat in Heat, Joe said, and got up and walked toward the lounge. I got up and ran after him.
Please don't spoil things. You know there wasn't anything.
I know, Joe said very clearly, that he knows what my wife looks like when she's getting fucked. And now the entire world is going to know it, too.
How can you say that? I have never in my life slept with anybody but you. You know that.
Behind me, Sam Forrest said, Take it easy, Joe. Cat's done nothing wrong. She might, in fact, want to ask you about the time you've spent with my good wife.
Joe's face went even whiter, but he dropped his eyes and walked into the lounge. Just beyond the doorway, he looked back over his shoulder.
Did you holler, cat?
I turned away blindly and went back to my seat.
I think we'll pass on dinner, Maria said, and got up out of her chair, and Colin followed her.
I simply could not think of what to say to Sam. It's a beautiful painting, I said dully. It really is. But I guess I didn't know you were going to do that. Didn't you? I did not reply. Had I known, I wasn't sure now. I'll go in and talk with him in a minute, I said. We drank our drinks in silence. After the last drink, things didn't look so bad. Sam reached out and touched my cheek very lightly.
In a way, I'm sorry the painting is done, he said. Maybe I can rework some of it.
He got up and gave me his hand and pulled me up. We walked into the bar to talk to Joe, but no one was there. We walked rapidly to the desk. A heavy young woman looked up, smiling courteously. Gilead, a Mr. Joe Gilead?
Ah, he leave you a note. She handed it to me.
Going to travel with the Deeks, it read. Maybe I'll see you in the morning. Maybe I'll see you in Rome.
He had signed it with a large, looping J. He was drunk.
What's up?
Sam asked. He was looking at me intently. Joe's decided to join the Deeks and see the world.
Jesus. Want to go down to Siena and look for him?
No. What I want is to go down to Siena and have a wonderful dinner and then go somewhere and dance. Or something. Will you take me to dinner?
I will. And to something, too.
We never did eat dinner. I think I knew when we set out in the Opal that we would not. I had a powerful sense that another woman entirely wore my skin that night, sat in the seat beside Sam Forrest as he drove, barbarously, down the sinuous road to Siena. This woman clung to the man in the driver's seat, leaned over to bite his shoulder none too gently. This woman did not come to eat dinner.
"I want some more bourbon," I said.
Sam headed for Il Campo directly on the piazza, but it was hopelessly jammed. We tried a few other restaurants on the square, but all of them were mobbed. In the end, Sam led me back into the warren of alleyways, and we found a tiny hole in the wall where only a few dark-clad men sat silently at tables, drinking. A silent waiter brought a bottle of whiskey. It was fiery and raw. The evening seemed to dim out then, to flicker, snap back into focus, blur again. We drank the bottle of whiskey and went somewhere else. We had whiskey there, too. Somewhere in that place, or perhaps the next one, there was a jukebox. I remember dragging Sam to his feet, laughing and dancing with him. I knew that I had drunk enough so that the Cat Gilead I had been would be out cold, but this new woman was still on her feet. On her feet, her body pressed hard against Sam Forrest. This woman nibbled and kissed his face and was still swaying when the music ended and the dim lights flickered on.
"I think they want us to leave," he said hoarsely. "So what now, Cat?"
"Now," I said. "Now I'm asking." At the sleeping villa, no lights showed. We stood in the semicircle of gravel.
"What do you have in mind, Miss Cat?"
he said. His tongue was as thick as mine. "I guess my room and yours are out," I said. "What do you think?"
"Christ, whatever's closest. I'm not going to be able to wait that long."
Then I did know. I pulled him behind me, around the side of the villa and down into the tangled vegetation that lay beyond it. By the time we reached the clearing, I was tingling all over with the night and what lay ahead. "Voila," I said, and stepped into the little glen where the falcon's cage was. The moonlight was so bright here that it seemed solid.
"Come here to me," he said.
I started forward, then stopped. "Wait," I said. "Wait just a minute." I ran across the glade and ducked into the little shed. I unbuttoned my linen dress and let it fall to my feet. My bra. My panties. My shoes. I ducked back out of the shed and stood before him in the moonlight.
"God, but you are beautiful. Come, Cat."
He got up on one knee and held his arms out to me. He did want me. I saw that he did. "Wait, just once more," I said, a new thought coming to my mind.
Wait and watch me. Watch me, Sam.
Jesus, Cat,
he said, and then, okay, I'm watching. I turned and ran across the glade toward the little hanging bridge. I hope you don't have any therapeutic ideas about fucking on that thing, he said. No. Now watch. I'm watching. I stopped at the lip of the bridge, took a deep breath, then ran onto it. It dipped and swayed sickeningly. At the very middle of it, I stopped and looked down. There was nothing below me but blackness. I stood for quite a little time, thinking of nothing at all except the feeling of the night on my naked body. Then I thought of his hands on it, and I turned and ran off the bridge and across the glade to Sam. He lay on his side, eyes closed, chest rising and falling serenely. All of a sudden, I was very tired and cold. I knelt beside him and shook him. Wake up, I whispered, shaking his shoulders. Sam, wake up.
Just a minute,
he mumbled, not opening his eyes.
Just got to rest a minute. Then we'll do it.
Sam, I'm cold.
Come here,
he said, eyes still shut, reaching his arms out to me. I dropped down and fitted myself into his arms. I burrowed close to him, wriggling until the entire length of me was pressed up against him. He was very warm. I closed my eyes. When I opened them, the glade was ashen with the gray mist that comes just before morning. And he was gone. I sat up, blinking. He had laid his blue jacket over me, and I held it close. I seemed to hear words.
You better fuck him fast, Cat,
Yolanda had said to me. I had, it seemed, waited too long. He had already made his love, and that was to the woman on the canvas. The woman in his arms last night had been the image. Oh, yes. There would be a new show soon. He was burning with it. I had thought that the burning was for me. I put my clothes on and smoothed my wild hair. Across from me, the falcon stirred her great wings silently. I went across the glade and opened the door to her cage. Go on, I whispered. No more cages for you. But she shrank back against the bars on the far side and did not move. I don't blame you, I said. It's not what it's cracked up to be. I started out of the glade to the gravel semicircle. There was no one about in the lobby. At my own door, I stopped. The door stood slightly ajar. I pushed it open and went in. Joe sat on the far side of the big bed. He turned slowly to face me, and I saw his eyes were sunken in blue hollows. He took a deep breath and let it out in a long, shuddering sigh. He said, Cat, where have you been? I've been out all night looking for you. I've just talked to the police. Incredibly, he smiled, but it did not hold. His mouth began to shake. They've gone, you know, Sam and Ada, Colin and Maria, gone back to Rome in the station wagon. I saw them as I was coming back this morning. He stopped. Of course they had gone. Sam was not anywhere in the air in this place. Ada would get some rest now. Her job was over. His was just beginning. Cat, he said finally. You and Forrest. Did you? No, I said. No, we never did. He did not move, but his shoulders slumped. He put his hands up to his face, and I saw Sam's handkerchief, white spotted with red. What did you do to your hand? I said. I knocked him down, he said. You knocked Sam Forrest down? I asked him where you were. He wouldn't tell me. Wow, I said. It sounded precisely as stupid as it was, but I could think of nothing else to say. He did laugh then. His shoulders shook with it. And I knew that he was crying, not laughing. Crying in a terrible way that I had never heard before. Please don't, I said. I thought you had gone, he said. I'd have died if you had, Cat.
I wouldn't have blamed you, but I'd have died.
I went around the bed and put my hands on the back of his shoulders and steered him to the bed. Let's sleep, I said. After that, we'll talk. He said nothing more, but he slid under the covers. I crept into the other side of the bed. After a long time, Joe said, "Can we go home again?" I thought of the stone house on the lip of the steep, the bright rooms washed by the clear air of the mountain, my garden with all its flowers blooming, the sofas indented by years of our bodies. I did not see us, though. Joe and I were not there. But then I looked again, and there were our shadows. The two of us, Shadow Cat and Shadow Joe, close together. We were still there then. I think so, I said. He did not say any more, but in a moment he reached his hand over and laid it on my hip, and I covered it lightly with my hand. I left it there, listening to his breathing. Pretty soon it slowed and deepened. Joe had always gone softly down into sleep. I felt my own sleep coming toward me then, but before it reached me, I heard the falcon. "Weechoo," she called. "Weechoo." I heard her. She made her old, immutable patterns back and forth. The call receded and came back. Finally, it did not come back. I listened as it climbed up into the vault of the morning one last time, and then it faded and faded and finally vanished. I could not hear it anymore. But I thought that if I got up and went to the window, perhaps I might see her, just for a moment, a speck against the sun that was only now brushing the tops of the city below us on the hill.